Good Wednesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Pardon me. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad you've joined us today. We have a fantastic program for you. Cameron Haynes going to join us. He's featured on NRA All Access on Outdoor Channel this week, 8:30 on Wednesday, March 23rd. If you are watching live here this afternoon, make sure you tune in tonight. Check out Cameron on NRA All Access. Always enjoy talking to another Cameron here on Cam and Company. J.D. Tuccilli of Reason will join us in Hour 3. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media. And I spent my morning out in Lynchburg, Virginia, on the campus of Liberty University, where Wayne LaPierre, Executive Vice President and CEO of the National Rifle Association, spoke to a crowd of, I'm guessing, close to 8,000 there at Liberty University's convocation. It was an amazing event. It was a great speech. We want to share the speech with you, actually, here in Hour 1. We're going to play it to you in its entirety. We'll take some breaks on the backside of the hour, and I've got some thoughts about being out there at Liberty and seeing that crowd. You know, this is one of the campuses in the United States where campus carry is actually allowed. And I got to tell you, I didn't see a lot of fearful faces. I didn't see any. I didn't see anybody afraid to raise their voice or speak their mind. You know, Bernie Sanders has actually spoken there on the campus of Liberty University, and nobody had any issues with it. So it's a great setting, I think, for a very timely speech by Wayne LaPierre, Executive Vice President and CEO of the National Rifle Association. Let's just take you to Lynchburg and Liberty University. We'll share Wayne's speech, and then we'll be back to talk about it later on in the hour. But here's Wayne LaPierre at Liberty University earlier today.
Hey, thanks so much. It's really an honor to be here with all of you at this absolutely amazing university. And Jerry, thanks for that introduction. I really appreciate it. I have a long history with Liberty. I used to actually come down here to spend time with Jerry's dad, Reverend Falwell. And in fact, we found a clip of that video, but I'd like to show you a little bit of it right now, if we can.
We'll get into why a Baptist preacher would be a member of the NRA, but I joined the NRA just as a regular member. But yesterday, I Federal Expressed to your office the lifetime membership check. Now, it probably hadn't cleared the bank yet.
Actually, Dr. Falwell, we have the check, and I brought with me your credentials, your new life member credentials, along with your certificate of membership.
Now, roll that camera right here. This is my lifetime membership. So if you hear Alan Dershowitz or someone accuse me of being a lifetime member of the NRA, they're right. This is the card, and I'll put it in my billfold after we go off the air. Go ahead.
You'll be joining President Teddy Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, and Charlton Heston, and General Joe Foss, and a lot of other Americans.
And I'm going to, Wayne, thank you for this. I'm going to put this on my office right beside my ordination certificate, and I'm going to tell everybody in a few moments why I believe it is so important. Let's put this back down here if we could.
Thank you so much for doing it.
To me, it is not a gun issue. I don't have time to hunt. Mm-hmm. In my lifetime, to my knowledge, I have never knowingly hurt anybody, and I pray I'll be able to say that just after I get to heaven, that I never have hurt anybody. But I have said from my pulpit that I believe every American under the Second Amendment has the right to bear arms, and if someone broke into my home to hurt my wife, my children, my grandchildren, I would plug them right here without praying about it. And I would hope that every daddy, granddaddy listening out there would take the scripture seriously, which says if a man will not care for or protect his own household, he is worse than an infidel.
Yeah, you know, what a lot of you may not know, and I know you know, Jerry, is Reverend Falwell had an amazing sense of humor. I remember being down here with him on one of those trips, and we were driving down the road and in his SUV, and all of a sudden he swerved in the other lane, and there was another SUV coming straight at us. And just before we got close together, he swerved back in the other lane, and Reverend Falwell broke out in a big laugh and said, "That was one of my football players. I just wanted to see if he was awake." And I'm like, well, you sure woke me up by doing that. So being here today really does bring a lot of memories back to me, and we're all blessed by Reverend Falwell, this great university, President Falwell, what you all have done with liberty. It is truly a gem in the United States of America that we as Americans should all be proud of, and our country's a lot better off for it. I wonder, and I think I know the answer, some NRA members out here in the audience today? Yeah. Thank you. Everything NRA accomplishes is people one by one all over the country. That's what makes it happen. And I really do appreciate all that support and all you do for the Second Amendment, for our country and our freedom, because the media always forgets it's just in people's hearts. We do it together. They make it sound like we're not the majority. We're the majority in this country, overwhelmingly. Now let me ask you another question. How many of you own firearms or believe in that great freedom to keep and bear arms? Thanks for standing up and exercising your real and personal liberty that's bestowed upon all of us by our Creator. Now, I'm not going to ask you to identify yourself here today, but I know that many of you are probably carrying a concealed firearm for personal protection. And the reason you're doing that is because the leadership of this university respects and encourages your Second Amendment rights. And here's the deal. Because so many of you have committed to the training and the responsibility of carrying a firearm, and because you have rejected that dangerous lie of gun-free zones, I'm standing right now in one of the safest places in the country. You know, the hard facts are we can't predict where evil may strike. The next campus, the next church, the next shopping mall, or airport. We do know evil will eventually strike again. And if, God forbid, a monster should walk onto this campus, that evil will be met with the one indisputable fact of liberty, that the surest way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Of course, there are some that don't agree with that. In fact, you and your university have been criticized for allowing students, faculty, and staff to carry concealed firearms. Well, I've been leading the NRA for almost 25 years now, and gun owners have been criticized and demonized by the media and those same political elites for as long as I can remember. They call us paranoid for arming ourselves for protection. They dismiss us as gun nuts. They blame us for tragedy that has nothing at all to do with lawful gun ownership. And they scorn us. They scorn us all for standing up for our rights. You know, we face a culture of leadership in this country that routinely lies on all kinds of fronts. I mean, think about it. Brian Williams, you can keep your health care. The border's more safe than ever. Benghazi, we face an epidemic of untruth at the highest levels of our country. The American public all over this country, citizens just like you, sit out there and say, oh my gosh, it's got to stop. And yet when someone does tell the truth, they get clobbered. It's like it's all upside down. Lies seem normal. The truth seems bizarre, like it's crazy talk. And the news media doesn't want to tell us what the news is. They want to tell you what to think. All of that is having a devastating impact on the kind of values, freedoms, and beliefs that our country was founded on. When you catch them in a lie, let me show you what you can do if you stand up to them. Please watch this video.
Now we give you the other side from the Executive Vice President of the National Rifle Association, Wayne LaPierre. Wayne, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kara. Good to be with you.
Well, if the ban on assault weapons expires, what kind of weapons would be legal?
Kira, let me say this at the start. I'm glad you ran that story, because apparently the only difference between the New York Times and CNN is that when a reporter for the New York Times fakes a story, he's fired, and at CNN he's not. Your bureau chief, John Zarella, deliberately faked a story yesterday intending to show that the performance characteristics of banned firearms on the list are somehow different from the performance characteristics of firearms not on the ban list. He was implying that these were machine guns or fully automatic guns. That's not true.
Mr. LaPierre, I have to stop you there. No one fakes stories at CNN, and John Zarella definitely did not fake a story at CNN. You're very off base. I'm going to let you say your opinion, and let's conversation, but don't accuse our reporter of faking any story, sir.
Let me say it again in front of the whole country. Your reporter faked that story yesterday. It deliberately misread the viewer. There's no way it could be true, and I challenge CNN to defend it.
Yeah. Here's the thing. CNN finally admitted I was right and ran a correction. But millions of viewers were deceived. And the really sad thing about that is this. If I hadn't happened to be sitting in the studio and caught him red-handed like a bank robber running out of the bank with a bag of dye exploding all over him, that lie would have continued to stand as truth. It's got to the point in this country where one of America's greatest vulnerabilities is the failure of the media to provide a level playing field for the truth. And it's up to all of us to hold their feet to the fire. It's up to all of you to call them out for their lies. And when you see them doing it, stand up to them. Get right in their face. Do something about it, because it can make a difference. So many of those elites, they think they're better than us. They somehow think they're more sophisticated. They think they're more intellectually evolved somehow than we are. Or they think they're just somehow plain smarter than we are. Well, I've got news for the elites who look down their noses at all of us and our rights. We gun owners are a heck of a lot smarter than you'll ever be. And it's true. In all of history, there's never been a group of citizens so engaged, so determined, so resolute, and so unified in defending freedom, so politically savvy and individually prepared and responsible for protecting our families and our communities. Never have been there been smarter, freer American citizens than America's 100 million gun owners. And let me say that again. In all of the world, some of the smartest citizens are American gun owners. And let me tell you why. Gun owners, law-abiding gun owners, are smart enough to know that when that evil monster comes, our survival is right there in our own hands. Gun owners are smart enough to know that government can't protect us. At the scene of the crime, and I know all of you know this, if you think about it, it's always the criminal and the victim. Despite everyone else's good intentions, they always come in later. You're there alone. Gun owners are smart enough to know that we, all of us, individually, are the first line of defense. And we're smart enough to know that the elites are lying when they try to tell you that one more gun control law is going to keep you safe. You want proof? Let's talk about Chicago. For the gun control crowd, Chicago is utopia. I mean, after all, they've tried every type of gun law they can think of in that town, from licensing to registration to gun bans. Their utopian dream is Chicago's nightmare. Already this year, 400 people have been shot in Chicago. Compared to a year ago, the homicide rate in Chicago has skyrocketed by 100%. Think about it, 100%. Does anybody think that sounds like success? As you know, Chicago is President Obama's hometown. In January, he participated in a so-called town hall meeting. In that town hall meeting, he denigrated law-abiding gun owners. He attacked the National Rifle Association, and he attempted to advance his own political agenda. And he called out the NRA. He implied that somehow we were afraid to meet him. As he said, hey, you guys are just down the street. Well, let me repeat right now what I said then. And I said again at the CPAC conference 2 weeks ago. And I'll be real crystal clear about it. Mr. President, if you want to debate over our Second Amendment freedom, if you want to turn this election into a bare-knuckled brawl over the rights of law-abiding gun owners all over this country, I challenge you to a one-hour debate with a mutually agreed-upon monitor on any network that will take it. No pre-screened questions, no gas bag answers. Mr. President, if you want that debate, bring it on. We're just down the street. What are you afraid of, Mr. President? You know, but there's been no response from the White House. The president keeps ducking me. And gun owners are smart enough to know, and I think you know it as you sit there today, and he's never going to debate me on guns. Gun owners know the president, if he debated me, would get his clock clean. And the president knows that, too. He also knows, and this is really important, he also knows he could pick up the phone and he could order his United States attorneys to flip Chicago upside down and prosecute every felon with a gun, every criminal gang member with a gun, and every drug dealer with a gun. If he did that, that would make Chicago safer. And until the president does that, Chicago is his failure. Chicago is his lasting legacy of rampant violence that he could, but he refuses to stop. Worse, Chicago's just the tip of the iceberg of Obama's failure. Let me tell you a story. It goes back to the 90s. I was sitting in my office one day in the late 90s. Richmond, Virginia had become the third most violent city of the country at that time. And this young prosecutor called me up and he said, Wayne, we don't know each other, but I've been reading your speeches. And I'm going to give you a chance to put your money where your mouth is. He said, I'm going to do what nobody's ever done in this town. He said, I'm going to put the federal gun laws on a card. Federal gun laws, existing federal gun laws. I still have one of the cards right here in my hand. And he said, I'm going to go into the police department, I'm going to tell them this. Every time they see a drug dealer with a gun, a criminal gang member with a gun, a felon with a gun, I'm going to tell them to call my office and we are going to prosecute them 100% of the time. We're not going to put them out on bail and we are going to take them off the streets. He went to the African-American community, the business community. He went to gun owners. He got everybody behind that program. He went into African-American churches and talked to the moms and said, I want to make your kids safe. Stop the killing. And you know what he did? He cut murder by that town in 60%, by 60%. He did it. He did it. And he told me this story. He said, Wayne, I was sitting at home one night, and there was another murder on TV. And my little girl looked at me and said, Daddy, can't somebody stop that? And he thought to himself, I'm the somebody. And he did something about it, and it worked. The program was so successful. You know what happened next? The Clinton administration squashed it. The prosecutor's career came to a halt. The Obama administration, they won't even discuss it. And Obama's former Attorney General, Eric Holder, called it a cookie-cutter approach to solving crime and dismissed it outright. Nobody's done it since in this country. Now in Hampton Roads, Virginia. Yeah, but here's the sad thing. Thousands of convicted felons have been caught with illegal guns. And most of them have never been punished. And just so you know, a convicted felon is prohibited from even touching a firearm. If he does or she does, the penalty is up to 10 years in federal prison. Same with criminal gang members. If you're caught dealing drugs and you have a gun and you're out on the street ruining neighborhoods, it's up to 15 years in federal prison. In Hampton Roads, however, 8 out of 10 felons found guilty of that don't spend one single day in jail. They're back on the streets. They're free to murder. They're free to rob. And they're free to ruin those neighborhoods. And here's the crazy part. The political elites, the national news media, the media celebrities accuse us, law-abiding gun owners, of being unreasonable. Let me tell you what's unreasonable. Letting bad guys go. Letting repeat offenders, violent offenders with guns, continue to ravage our streets and our neighborhoods in this country. If you want reason, you want smarts, then try it our way. Enforce the laws on the books. Clean up Chicago. Clean up Hampton Roads. Clean up Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, St. Louis, and all the other crime zones in this country. And do it by arresting them, prosecuting them, and sending them to prison, and that's what works. That will keep innocent citizens safe, and every law-abiding gun owner in America knows it. And you know who else knows it? Every rank-and-file police officer that's out walking those streets. They all know it, that's the answer, and they pray every day that our elected officials will only do it and start making this country safe. But sadly, the political debate in this country, it isn't about keeping people safer. It's all about banning guns, your guns. That's all the elites want to talk about, because that's all they really care about. It has nothing to do with making the country safer. Remember that story that President Obama talks about? He tells it all the time, of that poor 16-year-old girl that came to his inauguration and went back to Chicago, and she was killed by a criminal gang member back in Chicago. I'm sure you've heard it. He's told it, tells it all the time. What he doesn't tell you, and what the media is dishonest enough in this country not to report, is that criminal gang member that killed that poor 16-year-old girl should never have been out on the streets to begin with. He was convicted of gun charges. He was released on probation, put on the streets. He was picked up for numerous times while he was on the streets and was never taken off the streets, and he ended up killing that poor 16-year-old girl. No federal gun charges were ever brought from the Obama administration before that happened. It's a tragedy. It shouldn't have happened. Yet it happens in Chicago over and over and over again. I have really come to believe the president cares more about the story than he does about stopping it. And that's a really sad commentary in our country about our political leadership. Gun owners are smart enough to know that the president also cares more about restricting your freedom. He cares more than he cares about enforcing the existing federal gun laws and keeping people safe. And people all over this country have had enough of that kind of president. There's an election coming up. And we're smart enough and we're fired enough, up enough to do something about it. Our nation is going to be put back on its rightful course, where individual freedom is respected, where justice is restored, where laws are enforced, and government gets off our backs and leaves us the heck alone. It really comes down to this. If we could legislate evil out of people's hearts, we would have done it long ago. I used to do a television show, a radio show on Westwood One every Sunday night. And one of the guests used to be John Douglas. He was one of the top FBI profilers in this country. And I always remember something he said to me on that show. He said, "Wayne, if I learned one thing in my career, it's that some people are just pure evil." pure evil. And you heard Julia tell the story, descended on Brussels yesterday. Thank God her parents are okay. Our hearts and prayers go out to the Belgian people and the victims of that terror attack, including the families of innocent Americans who were there. If evil ever descends on your house at 2 a.m. at night and the glass breaks, there's not a government and there is not an authority on the planet that substitutes for your individual right to own a firearm to protect yourself. I remember after Katrina in New Orleans, we had people, it was chaos in that city. And we had camera crews down there asking people, were they okay, how they felt. And I remember we filmed this one African-American woman sitting on her porch. And the camera, the interviewer went up to her and said, are you scared? Because it was chaos everywhere. And she looked at him and she said, no, I have everything I need. I have my Bible and I have my gun. You know? All over this country, no one cares more about protecting themselves than women. 30 million American women now own firearms. That number is growing every single day. And the number one reason women give for owning a firearm is personal protection. Soccer moms have increasingly become safety moms, and they found a home in the National Rifle Association. Please watch.
I'm a mom, and just like millions of other women, that's why I own guns. We're responsible, we're law-abiding, and we're everything that makes America strong. Every day, we're willing to use a firearm to defend our families. But the media will never tell those stories. If a mom puts a gun to the face of a home-invading thug and makes him run for his life, the story gets buried. But if she's unarmed and murdered, the cameras will be at the scene before the police. It's time for moms like me to speak out. We are the majority. We demand the freedom to defend our families. And we challenge the media to tell the truth about our rights. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Yeah, I see a lot of young women out here today. I'll say this. No woman should ever, and I mean ever, have to face evil with empty hands. American women who own firearms know that you aren't free if you aren't free to defend yourself. Gun owners are smart enough to know that if Hillary Rodham Clinton would deny women that right, then she really doesn't care about women at all. Not one bit. And you know what really gets me is the hypocrisy of it all. While Hillary would deny women and men their Second Amendment rights and freedoms, she's surrounded by armed security and has been surrounded by armed security for most of her life. Hillary Clinton is just like a lot of other media elites and media celebrities and anti-gun politicians. They don't hate guns. They just hate our guns. Everything they care about, they surround with armed security. So every time Hillary Clinton attacks our Second Amendment freedom, gun owners are smart enough to say, hey, Hillary, you go first. You give up your protection if you want. But I am never going to surrender my individual right to own a firearm to protect myself. You can count on that. Hadn't found a gun control law she didn't like. It goes from national registration to licensing to bans, you name it. And if Hillary survives her primary, I'm talking about the real one, her FBI primary. Yeah. That's the real one. But if she does, she'll come after law-abiding gun owners with every onerous restriction and anti-gun Supreme Court nominee that she can appoint. All aimed at destroying our great individual Second Amendment freedom in this country. Hillary would wipe that away faster than she'd wipe away her server. Yeah. And gun owners and Americans are smart enough to know that. And I'll tell you what else. We're all smart enough to go to the polls and defeat her. We know, and all of you know, that freedom comes from the ability to protect ourselves. That we're individually empowered to take charge of our own security. Gun owners know that America, this amazing country, is the greatest, freest nation on earth. We're not confined by our own vulnerability, like citizens of the rest of the world, who have only their governments to rely on. Gun owners know that the only truly free people that have ever lived have been armed people, capable of defending themselves and their families. Gun owners are smart enough to know that all other freedoms lay behind the one essential freedom, the Second Amendment, that guarantees all the rest. And gun owners are smart enough to know the difference between Supreme Court justices who respect the Constitution and liberal appointees that, if they stacked that court, would rewrite the Bill of Rights, destroy our freedom for the rest of our lifetimes. And gun owners are smart enough to know that standing up for liberty and fighting for freedom is essential to saving our nation. Please watch this.
The only truly free people who have ever walked this earth have been armed people, capable of defending themselves and their families. Americans look in horror at supposedly free countries all over the world where innocent people live or die at the mercy of their government. We see what it's like to be French, German, or Belgian, where innocent people cower in fear as evil closes in, utterly aware of their own vulnerability, doomed to defend their families with rolling pins and broom handles. Let the rest of the world choose to live in fear. That false brand of freedom will never be ours. We are free to be as armed, trained, and prepared as we see fit. And we will never surrender that freedom to the global gun ban order. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Our Second Amendment freedom empowers each of you, all of us, to a freer life. Gun owners cherish that freedom and are smart enough to know that we must never let it be taken from us. That freedom separates us from every other nation on earth. It makes us stronger than other countries. It makes us better than other countries. That freedom makes us Americans.
I was born in Greece in 1939. Nazi warplanes bombed us unmercifully. Executions in the streets were common. I saw horror you could never imagine. Human beings became animals, starving and desperate. But me, I was lucky. Soon after the war, I saw the Statue of Liberty, and I cried. I've been blessed by the freedom and opportunity only America can offer. Today, I feel a duty to speak out. There will always be evil in this world, but the one thing that separates America from every other country is our freedom. And the one freedom that protects all the others is our Second Amendment. Never give it up. Never. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest
us. There's something very special about our country. There's a reason America is the envy of the world. Ours is the opportunity that can only come with that freedom. It is that freedom that's guaranteed by the Second Amendment. That freedom which the NRA stands and fights for. And when it comes to defending freedom, I'm proud of the fact no one fights harder, longer, or smarter than we do. Gun owners are smart enough to know that our freedom is at stake in this upcoming November election. And we're smart enough to know that we can and we will make the difference. We're smart enough to know that it will take all of us, every one of us, as Americans to do it. And it will take every one of you. Together, we are smart enough, capable enough, and absolutely determined enough to defend our liberty, win back the White House, take back our country, and we're going to do it in November. And don't ever forget this. Keep getting up every morning and fighting for freedom every day. And thank you for inviting me. It's great to be with all you at Liberty University. Thank you very much.
Wayne LaPierre, the Executive Vice President and CEO of the National Rifle Association, again, talking to the students there at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, earlier today. I'm so glad that we have a three-hour show so we can do stuff like that. And don't just have to play a soundbite for you, but you can actually hear the entirety of that speech. We're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, I've got some thoughts both about Liberty University and Wayne's speech. So stick around. We have a lot more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh, so I'm glad to hear.
Tell us, what is Armed in Heels all about?
So Armed in Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed in Heels to support the working woman, the empowered woman, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried. You were terrified. Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried. And then he put it away. And
I see.
It
okay.
maybe took 2 years to get the guts
really?
To do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No, no way.
No. So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. It seems you have it figured out. This, I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed in Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, listen up. You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends, but you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. That's what it takes. You haven't met the steel workers and the hard rock miners or the swamp folks in Cajun country who can wrestle a full-grown gator out of the water. You haven't met the farmers, the cowboys, the loggers, and the truck drivers. You don't know the mountain men who live off the land or the brave cops who fight the good fight in the urban war zones. No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America. And I'm freedom's safest place.
I know you're watching, so pay attention. You hate my freedom, my religion, and my country. You hate me for speaking my mind. You try to control me with violence and intimidation. You think you can muzzle me with fear? Don't ever confuse me for my politicians or my media. I am an American, free-born and free-bred. And I will call you out for who you are. An Islamic extremist who would kill me for my beliefs. You don't intimidate me. My freedom is more powerful than anything you can possibly do. And I will never, never surrender my rights to your terror. I will say what I think, worship according to my beliefs, and raise my children how I see fit. And I defend it all with the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. I cower to no one, because I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Still to come on the program, we're going to talk with Cameron Haynes, professional bow hunter, featured in NRA All Access this week on the Outdoor Channel. Also, Bob Owens of Bearing Arms, join us next hour with a 2A news whip from around the country, J.D. Trucilli of Reason, and Stephen Cruiser, PJ Media, coming up in Hour 3, along with the Hero of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, Deal of the Day as well. So I got to say, it was absolutely fantastic to be at Liberty University in Lynchburg earlier today. As you heard, quite a warm reception there for Wayne LaPierre from the students there at Liberty. But, you know, it's interesting talking with our technical director here in Farmville, Kyle, before the show began. And he noted, he said, you know, the atmosphere there is just very different than most college campuses that that I've been to. And he pointed out that when Jerry Falwell, president of the university, stepped up on the stage, this was not in the speech that you saw, he got, first of all, he got applauded and cheered by the students there. That doesn't happen very often, it seems, these days. And while it was respectful, it was also, you got the sense from a lot of the students there that the president of the university is a very approachable guy. There was a young NASCAR driver, high school student, getting ready to go to Liberty University in the fall and already racing. I think he's in the truck series this year. And he presented Jerry Falwell with a helmet. And the students, Jerry, put it on, put it on, put it on. I mean, and it was affectionate, just genuine affection. Which, again, if it happens on college campuses, we certainly don't read about it these days, do we? I'm looking here. Emory students demand Trump-free safe space. University of Arizona students demand free condoms and tampons. University of Davis students demand the ouster of their chancellor. Stanford students demanded the removal of a Catholic saint's name from campus buildings. You know, students, it seems like, have a lot of demands these days. Very angry about what their college seems to be. They want it to be something different. They're Western Washington State University, you know, they want a whole new a college to be set up. And they want to have $50,000 to throw a party to celebrate the founding of the new college, too. At Liberty today, I didn't see that. I didn't see a lot of anger. I saw, to be honest with you, I saw a lot of happy faces from students who didn't look bored to be sitting there at convocation. They were interested. They were engaged. And on a campus, again, where concealed carry is allowed, I'll tell you what, I didn't see fear at all. Now, we're going to take a quick timeout. We've got more NRA News, Cam and Company coming up, more thoughts about Wayne's speech at Liberty University. So stick around. We'll be right back with more right after this. From Arkansas State University, Dr. Eric Gilbert is with us. Dr. Gilbert, thank you for your time, sir.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you have a piece of the Chronicle for Higher Education right now. Stop worrying about guns in the classroom. They are already here. You are both a professor and an administrator there at Arkansas State, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And why did you decide that you wanted to weigh in on this issue?
Well, I think the, you know, with Georgia and Texas both in the news, and there have been some changes in our laws governing these things. Campus carry is, of course, not legal in Arkansas, but it's been the rules have been changed so that people with concealed carry permits can now keep guns in their cars on campus as long as the guns don't leave the car. So it's kind of been in the news and something people have been thinking about, and it's just seemed like the time was right to say something.
And your position seems to be, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that this is much ado about nothing?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a tempest in a teapot. I think the claims really on both sides of the debate are somewhat overblown. You know, as I say in the article, I think there are probably already a fair number of guns on campus, at least in my part of the country. And for the, you know, the bad things happen with those guns, but those are people who are bringing guns on campus illegally, often to do criminal sorts of things, or people who are discreetly bringing guns on campus not to do criminal things. And for the, in general, the one group does criminal things with their guns, the other group doesn't. And I don't think adding another probably a relatively small number of people with concealed carry permits is really going to change the calculus all that much.
You point out that concealed carry holders are not a particularly violent lot. You say in Texas they commit crimes at about the same rate as police officers and at a lower rate than the general public. You also point out something that I think has largely been lost in this debate, and that is that concealed carry holders have to be at least 21, so most undergraduates will not be eligible. And a matter of fact, you know, these are people who in many cases may already have their concealed carry license. This would simply be one place where they're not currently allowed to carry where they would be allowed to carry.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, at a campus like ours where we have a lot of non-traditional students, probably a third of our undergraduates or maybe 25% of our undergraduates are over 21. But it's still, you know, a minority of the of the undergraduates.
You know, and you also address a very common argument that I've seen from several professors. There was one professor at Georgia Tech who said, I will be afraid to teach the way I teach, and I think my students will be afraid to speak up if a concealed carry becomes the law, because someone could get upset and they could whip out their gun, and all of a sudden you've got people shooting at each other over a classroom discussion. And I'm glad to hear you say that you find this utterly implausible. I have to say I do too, Professor, because do you see a lot of fist fights right now breaking out in your class over, you know, disagreements in history or things like that?
No. And, you know, actually someone in the comments on that article actually pointed out that you know, he's been doing this for 25 years and nobody's hit him yet. So he assumes nobody's going to shoot him either. I think that probability of somebody losing their cool over, you know, whatever, how, no matter how controversial something is. Certainly that happens. People yell and scream. It doesn't happen very often, but it probably happens occasionally in classes. But I think the likelihood of someone shooting someone about something like that seems pretty remote.
Yeah, I mean,
that's not saying it couldn't happen, but, you know, it seems pretty unlikely.
I mean, you say most of us complain that our students won't even read, and now we're worrying about them being so engaged that they might throw caution to the wind and start shooting. In other words, you're more concerned about the, dare I say, apathy from your students or the...
Well, I mean, that's not to sort of indict students
sure.
and their level of interest, but rather, you know, if you read the Chronicle of Higher Education a lot, there's far more concern about the lack of student engagement. You know, we've had this book, Academically Adrift, which talks about the even at elite institutions, students are increasingly unengaged with their course material. And so most of the discourse about this is about lack of student engagement, except in this context where people seem to talk about how engaged in sort of emotional students are in their classes about content. And I don't doubt that there are classes where people get quite worked up, but if they're not throwing chairs at each other, they're probably not going to start shooting at each other.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Going to be joined by another Cameron next hour, Cameron Haynes. Professional bow hunter going to join us on the program. guest starring on this week's edition of NRA All Access, which airs Wednesday, March 23rd, 8:30 p.m. on Outdoor Channel. You can also check out, I believe, some repeat showings. Not quite sure what's going on there. Bob Owens of Bearing Arms is going to join us on the program as well, coming up next hour. I was actually reading an article. Fox News had a piece about Cameron Haynes. Posted, I think it was yesterday, as a matter of fact. Giving hunting a good name. It's a pretty good headline to get. Didn't call him calm and steady, but if you've watched Cameron, you know that he is, as a matter of fact, a calm and steady individual. One thing that's different about Cameron Haynes and myself, Cameron runs 100-mile-long ultramarathons. I do not. Cameron Gray, I don't think, I think you're with me, right? Unless you've taken this up as a hobby and haven't told me.
I've gotten to 50. Then I kind of run out of steam. That's feet.
This is like cumulative, right? Over the course of like a SHOT Show, maybe. Right.
It's my lifetime odometer.
Right. So we'll talk with Cameron Haynes next hour. I'm really excited about this. And Kyle just told me he's running 200 miles in August. And doesn't he know that's it's August? That's this is why we need a national holiday in August, because there's nothing to do, right? And so then we do stuff like that. We run 200 miles. Well, I say the royal we. Other Camerons run 200 miles in the heat of August. Good luck to Cameron Haynes. I'll have to ask him about that next hour. See if there's not something that we could do to go to Six Flags or something. Maybe, you know, go ride like the 10 highest roller coasters in August. I don't know. Running 200 miles is way down on my bucket list. But we'll talk with Cameron next hour, also with Bob Owens of Bearing Arms. And I did want to talk a little bit more about Wayne Lapp here at Liberty University today. You know, we talked about the attitude of the audience there at the Vine Center. And again, it was about 8,000 people, I'd say. Maybe a little bit more. Holds about 8,000 for basketball, about 10,000 for other gigs. I got to say, it looked pretty full. So somewhere between 8,000 to 10,000 people. And as the students were filing in this morning, doors open. I got there about 9:30. I'm listening to the band practice some of their praise songs. And then the doors open up and people are filing in. And I didn't see, maybe it's in the wrong part of the arena, but I didn't see the person who looked unhappy to be there. And like I said, I certainly didn't see any fearful faces. You know, Liberty has hosted just this campaign season. Ted Cruz, Bernie Sanders has spoken there. I think Donald Trump has spoken there. And Jerry Falwell has said, you know, look, I don't think we have a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters in our student body, but that's not really the point. The point is to expose them to ideas and viewpoints. Again, that academic freedom. Now, here you have the president of this university saying, I want my students to be challenged. And this is also a university where concealed carry is allowed. As a matter of fact, the Liberty University Police Department teaches concealed carry courses to interested students and faculty. We're told that that's not supposed to happen. That if a campus allows for the lawful concealed carrying of firearms by concealed carry holders, that the president's message should be, everybody shut up and watch your mouth, because you don't know what's going to set somebody off. Right? And instead, we see the opposite happening at Liberty University. So here's my question that I don't think any of the anti-gun academics and professors could really answer. Is there something different about Liberty University? Is there something special about that campus and those students and that faculty that makes campus carry work where it couldn't work for you? Liberty's a big place. They've got about 15,000 students there on campus. So it's not a size thing. It's not, well, it's a small school. It would never work at a big institution. No, that's pretty big. Is Liberty a special place, and what makes it special? What makes campus carry work there
where it couldn't work on your campus? Or is Liberty not particularly special? Is Liberty University, the student body there, the faculty, are they generally like most of the other faculty, student body of other higher education institutions around the country? And if that's the case, why can't campus carry work as well on your campus as it does on Liberty? Or frankly, Colorado State, or the University of Colorado, or the University of Utah. I mean, we can go on, but I was there at Liberty today. And ever since, I've been wondering what a member of, let's say, Gun-Free UT would say if they were confronted with that question. Because, again, all of the concerns that I have seen laid out by these professors, I didn't see any of them on display or in evidence there in Lynchburg, Virginia, at Liberty University today. They weren't there. All right, stick around. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up. Cameron Haynes, Bob Owens, and more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information right after this quick timeout.
Speaking with Command Sergeant Major Patrick Valdez, he's retired, and he's now with Freedom Hunters. Patrick, thank you so much for being here, and we'll go right to the shot of what you tell us what you do, because this makes a very big impression when you wield this up to the set here. Tell us what's Freedom Hunters all about, and tell us about the chair.
Freedom Hunters, we're a nonprofit. We take all veterans, all wars, all branches, and outdoor shooting activities, to include hunting, target shooting, trap, long range, whatever we can get the guy out. It started out with the Wounded Warrior Program at Fort Carson, Colorado, and to get guys out of the barracks, kind of like what Healing Waters did. It's hunting and getting guys outdoors. When you get back from a combat environment, you want to go back and do the things you did before. You want peace, you want calm, you want quiet. And getting guys outdoors and gals is our primary mission.
So tell us about the chair you brought along.
The chair is an amazing device. It's the Action Track chair. It's an American-made. It runs 5 miles an hour. We can get guys, and I say guys meaning guys and gals, into places they can't get with a normal wheelchair. Little skinny tires get stuck in the mud, stuck in the sand. We put them in this, and we can get them right to a blind. We can get them to a duck or a goose blind. We've taken them elk hunting, mule deer out west. We've even taken them fly fishing. With it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it can go into a little bit of water, not a lot. Awesome. But it is battery operated. And it's just a great tool to get guys out. And it gives them independence. It gets the guys in a chair the freedom to get off the concrete and get into the snow, sand, dirt, whatever. And not have to worry about getting stuck.
So why did you do this?
You know, I started out as a patient in the program. I got injured in Iraq in February of 07. And Freedom Hunters came to me and said, when they were really small, they said, we heard you want to go do something different. And I'd never been waterfowl hunting, so they took me, and that's how I started with them. So I was initially a patient in the program. Cool. Then I became a mentor. Now that I'm retired and have a little more time on my hands, I work as an outreach coordinator, helping the guys out.
That's awesome. Talking with Patrick Valdez with Freedom Hunters. So, Patrick, I was out at Camp Perry one time at the Nationals there, and I knew exactly what you're talking about. There was another organization who worked with wounded vets, and they got them out hunting and shooting. Those guys just, you know, it's what they grew up doing. It's why a lot of them got into the service to begin with, and they're just so happy just to be getting out there again and just being out with the guys. It's hugely impactful to them.
Well, it's an independence issue. You know, when they get back, they're well medicated, they're being taken care of, they have all of these appointments, and then they're like, I just want to go be by myself or get back into the wild. And especially at Camp Perry, it's a little sandy there.
Yeah.
And I've seen what wheelchairs do there, and they sink. And then all their buddies, usually four of them, drag them to the firing line. You know, and I've been on hunts where we didn't have a track chair available, and we had to drag the guy in his chair up to a blind.
Yeah. So something like that chair can't be cheap. So tell me, I'm obviously you guys probably need support. So we've got about 30 seconds left here. Tell us about Freedom Hunters. How can people get involved? How can they help out?
Freedomhunters.org, first of all. Come to our site. Vets can register and to get on a hunt themselves. Landowners can bring opportunities to shoot. There's the Independence Fund that's available, and Action Track Chair has their own 501c3 where there are scholarships available or funding available to get a chair on your own.
Patrick Valdez, Freedom Hunters, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for being here on NRA News. Please keep up good work and stay in touch, okay?
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Coming up, we're going to talk with the star of NRA's All Access this week, professional bow hunter Cameron Haynes, also Bob Owens of Bearing Arms. Last hour, shared with you Wayne LaPierre's address at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, where, among other topics, Wayne, one of the recurring themes was how do you combat evil? And even the acknowledgement that evil exists in this world. So let's talk about what's going on in Brussels, Belgium today with the investigation into the attacks yesterday. USA Today with a story on one of the individuals involved in the terror attacks. Prosecutor Frederick Van Loo said that Ibrahim El Bakroui, 29, one of the airport suicide bombers, his brother Khalid, age 27, was the subway suicide bomber who detonated his device an hour later at a downtown metro station. The identity of two other terrorists, one of whom is believed to have escaped, remained unknown on Wednesday. The president of Turkey, Erdogan, said that Turkey had deported Ibrahim last year, said that he was deported to the Netherlands at his request after his native Belgium failed to establish a connection to terrorism. According to the president of Turkey, he said both nations were notified. Khalid, in recent months, USA Today reporting, was the subject of an international red notice, an Interpol alert, saying that he was wanted on terrorism charges. Belgian prosecutor, Van Loo, alluded to a history of criminal activity from the men. NBC reported that Ibrahim was sentenced to 9 years in prison for shooting at police with a, quote, assault rifle during a robbery. Khalid was arrested for possession of Kalashnikov rifles in 2011, and had also been sentenced to 5 years for carjackings, apparently. And maybe the European version of the deal of the day, because it doesn't sound like they actually served the entirety of their sentences. Meanwhile, you have a lot of people in the intelligence community who are wondering what happens next, and not necessarily what happens next, just in terms of what will ISIS do and what will the individuals who are inspired by ISIS, but what will nations do? What will the leaders of the free world do? John Schindler is a former intelligence analyst. He is at 20 Committee on Twitter. He has a piece in the New York Observer today that is well worth reading. Europe is again at war is the headline. He says it has happened again. Jihadists have struck in the heart of Europe, spreading terror while murdering dozens and maiming hundreds of innocents. Yesterday's coordinated attacks on Brussels have woken Europeans yet again, he says, to the threat that exists in their midst, a grave danger that politicians seem to have no idea how to handle. He says Belgium's a small country relative to population. The casualties yesterday would be the equivalent to 900 dead Americans and a staggering 7,800 wounded. To say nothing of the symbolism of yesterday's attack on the metro in downtown Brussels, right next to the offices of the European Union, striking at the very heart of the European project, revealing its vulnerability to handle even a handful of ardent madmen, sends a powerful message that nobody can miss. He says, Belgium's very status as a jihadistan of sorts gave the country a degree of protection until very recently. While mass casualty attacks struck across Europe since 9/11, Madrid in 2004, London in 2005, Paris twice last year, Belgium was left nearly unscathed, he says. Radicals appreciated that Brussels, being lax in security matters, was granting them de facto sanctuary to plot attacks elsewhere. This was a deal that the terrorists sensibly saw no point in disrupting. Now, how did this happen? There was another opinion piece in the Chicago Tribune by a native of Belgium. He's left the country, apparently, runs a capital management firm in London. Jean-Michel Paul is the founder and chief executive of Acheron Capital. And he writes about how Belgium got to this point. You know, we had the story yesterday. BuzzFeed reported that the Belgian security, military, and police intelligence are just overwhelmed. That everybody, according to one Belgian official, everybody is being tasked to deal with these terror investigations. That they are spread too thin. And there was some references to, you know, the sort of a war within the bureaucracy and warring factions. Jean-Michel Paul, in this piece at the Chicago Tribune, kind of elaborates on this. And he says it's not necessarily in Belgium, at least he doesn't describe the political split. But he talks about the split between the different ethnic groups in Belgium, the French speaking, and then the Flemish speaking, and how they don't get along. He says at the same time, it's been squeezed by an ambitious European project that subsidized and empowered the country's regions at the expense of the state. Belgian institutions were left hollowed out, impotent to address the strains of immigration and impotent to penetrate a rising extremist threat. He says this is, at root, a story of failed investment in all forms of capital. Now, keep in mind, this is the founder of a capital management firm, so he might be seeing it through that lens. But he says, for election cycle after election cycle, politicians squandered the wealth of the state to buy their way to power. Investment became superfluous, vote buying and social spending the priority. Belgian voters who allowed this state of affairs to persist share some of the blame. When Belgium's ironworks and coal mines were closed, governments preferred to deny the inevitable outcome and borrow to subsidize these loss-making industries. The nation's public debt burden soared to a peak of 140% of gross domestic product. Rather than meet debt reduction requirements for joining the new euro currency in the 1990s, Belgium's government chose to fudge budgets, airbrush statistics, sell assets at fire sale prices, and bring critical investment to a standstill, and the result was catastrophic. Public spending on investment fell by more than half to just over 2% of GDP from 5% in 1980. He says at first the effects could be ignored because Belgium was able to rely on past stock, but the cushion disappeared long ago. Everything from, you know, roofs leaking in museums, potholes on the roadway, half-built train systems. He says funds were available for all of these priorities, but politicians funneled the money elsewhere. Social transfers, a sure vote winner, increased from 31% of GDP in 2014 from 23.5% in 1980. The increase went to handouts such as lifelong unemployment benefits, early retirement pensions starting at age 50. As if that wasn't enough, he says, Belgium's political parties divided public sector employment between them. To be a journalist in the public television station, one needs to have a political party affiliation. The same goes for even minor jobs at the municipal level. Political connections, rather than merit or hard work, determine advancement. Oh. Okay. So that's how we got there. And, you know, again, it's not inconceivable to see an American version of that happening here, is it? Is it? So back to John Schindler's piece of the New York Observer, talking about specifically what is going on in Belgium now and more broadly, what is going on in Europe. You may have seen a headline or two talking about this perhaps being the new normal in Europe. And John actually says this is not an isolated attack. This is now a guerrilla war that is being waged in European capitals and communities all across the continent. He says Belgian intelligence has long been short of funds and personnel, and above all, any political will to do anything substantive about the country's vast jihadist problem. Belgium's chronically dysfunctional politics have played a toxic role, as has the general Western European tendency to avert eyes and hope for the best regarding the growing radicalism of whole swaths of young people in the Muslim ghettos that exist in most of their cities now. Now, here's where I think John really puts on his intelligence analyst hat. He says there is no intelligence solution to the problem. And when an intelligence analyst tells you, hey, there's no intelligence solution to the problem, that should kind of make you sit up a little bit. He says, although more funds and better information sharing will surely help prevent some terrorism, and especially catch terrorists after they kill innocents, the threat is now so great, with Europe possessing thousands of homegrown radicals bent on murder, that mere spying cannot prevent all attacks left of boom, as the professionals put it. He says, you just don't have the manpower. You don't have the manpower, can't keep up with the technology. You're not going to be able to do it simply through intelligence. He says the depressing bottom line is that even the best intelligence cannot compensate for political failings on an epic scale. Simply put, he says, Europe has imported a major threat into its countries, one that did not exist a couple of generations ago. It can be endlessly debated why this problem has grown so serious so quickly, but that the threat is large and growing can no longer be denied by the sentient. So, he says, what's to be done? He says, admitting the extent of this threat is the necessary first step, albeit one that the EU's political class seems congenitally unable to address. I would throw our own leadership in there as well. We saw the president yesterday say, listen, can't let the terrorists win. We got to live our lives as normal, and I'm here in Cuba, and I want to go see a baseball game, so I'm going to go see a baseball game. So don't you worry. And again, that's great. We do want Americans to live their life as normal. We also want our heads of state to live their lives as normal. And generally speaking, after a major terrorist attack in a major European capital, the president of the United States would not be hanging out at a baseball game, right? Just my opinion. He says Europe is at war again. And the threat today is less terrorism than a low-grade insurgency, a guerrilla war of sorts that hangs over much of the continent as thousands of jihadists made proficient killers by ISIS in Syria and Iraq return home with visions of killing infidels, their former neighbors. He says there'll be no parley or negotiation with such mass murderers. Parsing the death cult ideology that drives ISIS fighters with the hope of making it less noxious makes as much sense as trying to divine the finer political points of the Manson family. So he says we should expect more. More attacks like what we saw in Brussels yesterday. Moderate in scale. Relatively easy to plan and execute against soft targets and utterly terrifying to the public. He says at some point angry Europeans fed up with their supine political class will begin to strike back, and that's when the really terrifying scenarios come into play. He says when that violence comes, a practically disarmed Europe will be all but powerless to stop it. He says today's Belgian army has two brigades, six infantry battalions, some 3,000 bayonets in all. Compare that to a generation ago at the end of the Cold War when Belgium's army had seven brigades with 18 infantry battalions and some 30 more battalions in the reserve. In other words, it's not just the intelligence sectors that are spread thin right now in Belgium and across much of the rest of the continent. I have to tell you this. It's a deeply pessimistic take on what the short-term future holds for Europe. But John Schindler didn't get paid to write happy talk. He had a career in intelligence providing his unvarnished truth, at least as much as he could get away with. So when he doesn't present a particularly rosy picture for the future, I think it is worth noting. Look, I hope he's wrong. I hope that ISIS is defeated on the battlefields of Iraq and Syria, and their ideology is defeated wherever it is found around the world. And I hope it happens quickly. But, you know, I saw a story last night. The European premiere of Superman. But is it Batman versus Superman or Superman versus Batman, Cameron?
thankfully, resident nerd Justin behind me said Batman versus Superman. V.
Thank you, Justin.
I'm sorry. He even said V. I How dare me.
So, okay. All right. Well, thank you, Justin. I appreciate it. All comic questions will go to Justin now. They canceled the European premiere last night because of security concerns. And my first thought was, well, yeah, that's because superheroes don't exist in real life. There's no League of Justice that could protect that premiere. It would take real flesh and blood human beings to protect that premiere. And you know what? I think those real flesh and blood human beings who are available to protect an event like a movie premiere are tasked now. Pretty much, again, all of them are tasked now with more important business than standing guard over celebrities. Because, again, I think John's right. I think this is the start of a very abnormal new normal. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout, Cameron Haynes is going to join us, professional bow hunter. He is guest starring on this week's edition of NRA All Access. Stick around. We'll be right back with more. NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors. Welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes. That's Tell great. Us what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball. I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. When I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch-thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you when people do this. And out of necessity, what's born this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day. Right now, the numbers from the DOD, it's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
You and I didn't choose to be targets in the age of terror. But innocents like us will continue to be slaughtered in concert halls, sports stadiums, restaurants, and airplanes. No amount of bloodshed will ever satisfy the demons among us. These cowards dream of inflicting more damage, more suffering, more terror. No target is too intimate or too sacred for these monsters. They will come to where we worship, where we educate, and where we live. But when evil knocks on our doors, Americans have a power no other people on the planet share. The full-throated right to defend our families and ourselves with our Second Amendment. Let fate decide if mercy is offered to the demons at our door. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I want a woman president, but I want an honest president more. I want someone who can place their hand on a Bible and swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution without telling a lie. Someone who believes in the integrity of that office. A president whose actions reinforce the moral lessons I teach my children. There are many powerful, accomplished women in both parties who meet and exceed that standard. But you, Mrs. Clinton, are not one of them. Your past is littered with shameful, dishonest behavior. Decades of decisions that point toward your own power and fortune, not the best interest of women, the country, or the truth. There is no greater threat to my freedom than another dishonest president. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Still to come on the program this hour, Mr. Bob Owens of Bearing Arms. Tonight on Outdoor Channel, 8:30 Eastern, be sure to check out NRA All Access. You should be checking it out every week. But tonight, very pleased to have with us on the program right now, the guest star on this week's NRA All Access, professional bow hunter Cameron Haynes is with us. Cameron, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I am excellent. It is it's fantastic talking with you. It is always good talking to another Cameron, first of all. But
likewise,
I got to tell you, I walked into to work this morning, and Kyle Morgan, who you just spoke to, our technical director here in Farmville, said, you know, most of the time I don't get envious, but I'd like to shove you out of the chair today and do this interview myself. because you know, he is a wonderful hunter. I mean, he is a true outdoorsman, and he holds you in such high regard, as do a lot of other folks. And so that's my first question for you is, you know, clearly you understand that you represent more than just yourself. What does that mean to you to have that responsibility?
I don't know. I mean, it's good. It's it feels good on one hand, and then you know, I feel like an obligation to walk the walk on the other hand, which is fine. I just want to work hard every day. I know people look up to me. I know people are inspired by me. And so I just want to make sure that I'm living up to, I guess, what they expect of me. And so I'm just, I hammer every day. I push it hard. I want to be somebody, I just want to be a good role model and represent hunting well. And then also on the flip side, I get inspired by all those people that look to me and they, you know, I get the messages and say, hey, I've lost this much weight. I did this. I never thought I could. And that in turn, it really inspires me. So it's a win-win really, but it feels pretty good.
You know, I was reading an interview that you did with Fox 411, which was posted yesterday, and I want to quote something that you said here. They asked, you aren't the typical hunter. You see hunting as a sport, and you say you want to change the way people see hunters. And you said that people who are not hunters, they think of someone who just load up their trucks, they get some beer, and they maybe shoot at animals with no regard. And you say that's not accurate. In reality, we care about the animals that we hunt, and we love the country that the animals live in. You say you prepare for the hunt like a professional athlete prepares. If you're going to kill the animal, you need to be at your best. You want it to be an ethical kill. It's a big deal to take the life of an animal, and it's not like going and buying a steak at the grocery store. You know, we're getting ready to butcher a couple of hogs this weekend. And I got to tell you, Cameron, that's the part of raising my own meat that I hate, you know, is taking that life that, you know, we've grown up since little piglets. It sucks in a way. I'm grateful for the opportunity. But, you know, again, you talk about that reverence for life. And I think this is where so many anti-hunters have that block. They can't understand how you can say you have reverence for the life that you are taking. Can you explain that a little bit more?
It's just like you with your pigs, is you have a connection to the animal. I mean, you know what the end result's going to be or what it needs to be, but still you have that connection. Well, hunters have the connection with the animals we pursue, and you know, the anti-hunters or whoever that want to condemn us, they don't have that connection. They it's all separate. They go and they buy their hamburgers or they buy their whatever. There's no, they don't even equate it to real life. For hunters, it's different than with you with your pigs, of course. It's still a connection, but with hunters, like for me growing up as an elk hunter here in Oregon, it's like everybody dreamed of a big bull elk, killing a big bull elk or pursuing a big bull elk, just being close and smelling elk, you know, how they are, and, mm-hmm. and hearing a bugle. And it's like the first time you even see one, it's almost like a mythical creature, you know, there, because you think about it 365 days a year, and then it's there, and then you have to transition from that. Okay, now I was in awe just seeing it. Now how do I get this thing killed, especially with just an arrow like I bought with a sharp stick, essentially. And so when you have that much into it, that much emotion involved, there's reverence. I mean, that animal represents so much, you know, hopes and dreams and thoughts over the years. And when it finally happens, yeah, it's the anti-hunters might think, oh, we're bloodthirsty killers out there. Couldn't be further from the truth, at least for me. It represents all the blood, sweat, and tears that I put in, and finally a goal has been achieved. And that's what killing a big bull elk means to me, and I think a lot of hunters would agree.
Talking again with Cameron Haynes, who is a guest star on this week's NRA All Access. All right, so I've got to ask you, Cameron, you run a lot more than I do, like mm-hmm. ever. I tend to run when something's chasing me, and that's about it.
Right.
But what drives you? And I heard that you're going to be running 200 miles in August this year. Is that right?
Yeah.
Can we talk that's you out goal, of this yeah. in any way? Can we, like, you ever thought about, like,
no.
trying to hit up all of the roller coasters in North America instead or doing something? I mean, what?
To me, running is it's just a form of discipline that I feel like I need. I mean, running isn't always fun for me either, but I know I just feel like every day I want to do something to be better, to improve myself, to be better in the mountains. And the easiest thing to feel like I put in work is to run, you know, because it's hard. And I like that test every single day. I like working up the sweat. And I know at the end of the day that, okay, I did something. I did something positive. I can feel good. And so, you know, that's just internally, that's just what I need. And then as far as the races go, like the Bigfoot 200 that I'm running in August, that's just, to me, I just want to get out of my comfort zone. I want to know what it feels like. You know, in general life, everyday life, we have a lot of good things, a lot of positive. We have, life's pretty good here in the United States, and we have a lot of comforts. And I like to be able to appreciate those, I need to take those away, and I want to be miserable, and I want to know what struggle really feels like. And that's what happens on those races. And that's, you know, it's going to happen in the Bigfoot 200. It's going to be a huge test, but I know it's temporary. And once I accomplish it, I'll just, you know, I'll feel good and look for the next one.
50,000 feet of ascent and more than 96,000 feet of elevation mm-hmm. change in 200 miles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cameron, you're going to feel it, buddy.
Yeah, I'm excited. I wish it was this weekend, actually, but I got to wait.
That is awesome. I am in awe of that accomplishment, and I would love to have you back on after you run that. But that brings me to another question. In talking with Kyle, I said, you know, you can't shove me out of the chair today, but if there's a question that you would mm-hmm. like to ask Cameron, what would it be? And
he already asked me one, by
the
way.
He did. Okay. Well, this might be the same question, but it's a good one, and so our audience, I think, is going to want to hear the answer to this. How do you train? I mean, you talk about the amount of that you are running, mm-hmm. and you're running in rugged terrain. It's not like you're running on the flat prairies of Kansas or Nebraska. You're mm-hmm. out there in Oregon. You are obviously, you know, you're in great shape. But how do you train if you're not in that same sort of rugged environment? How do you train to go and hunt an elk if you can't run up and down a mountain every day?
Yeah, it's a good question. I also weight train. So I think a combination of getting your cardio up with running on the flat. I mean, I still run on the flat sometimes if I'm short on time or I have to run from work here or something. And I'll run on the streets and the sidewalks just like anybody else. And I just pick up the pace. So, I mean, I'm getting that cardio because I'm pushing my heart a little harder, and so I get my heart rate up. So that's that. That's the one part. That's what you need to hunt the mountains. You need to have your cardio, but then also you need the leg strength. So that's what that is where I would incorporate some weight training. And it doesn't have to be crazy. You know, it's a mountain athlete, like we like to say nowadays. That's just somebody who hunts the mountains is built from the ground up. So it's your legs. I mean, doing walking lunges, which means, you know, you're holding dumbbells in each hand and you're just doing a lunge, which is a long stride. And then your back leg goes down and your knee touches, and then you take another stride and the other knee touches. And you do, you know, four sets of 25 of those, just walking lunges, holding 25 pounds in each hand. That is a good workout, and you're going to build those legs up. And it's just something as simple as that, along with the jogging.
I'm exhausted just listening to you describe this.
No, you could do it. I believe in you.
Sure. Well, thank you, Cameron. I appreciate that. I don't think I could, but I could start. Baby steps, maybe a two-miler up a mountain. So let's talk about your guest starring role here on NRA All Access this week. I mean, you are a bow hunter. You are also, I'm guessing, an NRA member and a supporter of the right to keep and bear arms?
Oh, absolutely, yep. We have guns in the house, for sure. My kids rifle hunt. I only bow hunt. I started bow hunting almost 30 years ago, and that's all I've been doing. But, NRA supporters, big Second Amendment people, and we like shooting guns. So, yeah, it's a big honor to be on the show tonight, for sure.
Why is it important for you to protect that right and to exercise that right?
That's the basis of our freedoms here in the United States, is the right to bear arms. And I'd look at it as an obligation. I want to be able to protect my family. So my entire family, from my daughter up to my sons, knows their way around guns, knows how to operate safely, how to shoot, how to load, how to everything else. And so I feel good that they know that. I want to be able to protect them. And I want to be able to, if need be, protect friends and family that aren't in my house. If anything happens somewhere or an innocent bystander needs protection, I want to be that guy. So I feel like it's just important. I mean, it's in our Constitution. It's part of it's part of being American, I think, is the right to protect and bear arms. So, I mean, it's a big deal, and I'm so thankful for the NRA for their stance on protecting that right.
Talking again with Cameron Haynes, you can catch him on NRA All Access this week. And one more question for you, Cameron, I have no idea what your answer is going to be here, but when you look at the future, and you think about the future that your kids are going to live in when they're adults, do you feel positive? Do you feel optimistic, or do you feel a little concerned? Because I could see it going both ways. I mean, on the one hand, you are a successful professional hunter. You're sponsored by Under Armour. We've got people, I think a growing number of people who are starting to hunt. I think we've got a lot of people who are becoming cognizant of the right to keep and bear arms. But on the same, on the opposite side, we've got a lot of outspoken anti-hunters who attack people like you every opportunity that they can. We've got, people who obviously don't think that we have a right to keep and bear arms and would love a Supreme Court that would try to negate those rights away. So are you positive, concerned, maybe a mixture of both?
Yeah, I mean, of course I'm concerned, especially with this political climate right now. There's a lot at stake. I don't think any of us can stand back and just be spectators. I read stats that only 50% of Americans vote. I think that's crazy. Some people are, well, until it affects me, I'm not going to worry about it. I think that's the wrong stance to take. Because what we have could go away. It's weird. It's like America, because I've traveled all over, so I've been to different countries, and I see the freedoms and liberties that we have here, not everybody has, and we take those for granted. I mean, 9/11, when that happened, that was when you saw the patriotism and the flags and everything else, and people thought, well, whoa, our freedoms were really attacked. I mean, this is a big deal. This happened at home, and people were they were proud to be Americans. Well, now all of a sudden that's years down the road and people have been taking things for granted. And now it's like we get too comfortable. And it's just like we need to fight every day to protect what we have. We need to be proud to be Americans. We need to, you know, if it's the right to bear arms, we need to fight to protect that. So I think the elections, I think just everyday life, I try to promote that and in a positive way. I'm not out there slinging hate at anybody, but it's in a positive way, the hunting lifestyle, the, you know, shooting guns and knowing guns and just being proud to be an American. I try to celebrate that every day and hopefully in a way that, you know, inspires others to also, because, you know, like I mentioned, and like you mentioned too, I think it's a delicate time right now. There's a lot at stake and we just need to be aware of it every day that, you know, this, we could have things taken from us. So we need to fight to protect them.
Absolutely. Cameron, listen, I really appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, and can't wait to watch NRA All Access tonight. Let me give you one final softball for you, all right? Okay. Just because I'm curious. All right. Is there anybody on your hunting bucket list that you want to hunt with, that you'd love to hunt with, but you haven't had the chance to go out with yet?
Oh, man. You know, I've had chances to hunt with, I don't know, I guess people would call them celebrities, you know, Luke Bryan, Joe Rogan. But I'll tell you what, above any celebrity, I just like taking new hunters out. I mean, that was one reason why I took Joe out. He had never bow hunted before. And I didn't care that it was Joe Rogan and he calls UFC and he's Fear Factor or anything like that. It was just that he was a new hunter and I was going to be able to see him and see how he reacted when he saw a bear for the first time, when he had a bow in his hand, and the objective was to kill and take that meat home. So for me, it's not really who it is. I'm not really enamored with celebrities, so to speak.
Yeah.
But it's just exposing new hunters to what we love and the passions that have changed my life. That's it. So, I mean, if it'd be anybody new, whether it's a kid or an adult that had never experienced it, that's what I look forward to and dream about. So it wouldn't really be a person. It would just be a specific person and just be a new hunter.
All right. Well, listen, I'll tell you what, Cameron, I'm going to start my endurance training. And at some point, okay. I hope to be in good enough shape to not embarrass myself in front of you. And you can see how I will react in front of a bear.
Oh, I'd love it. I'd love it. You just let me know and we'll make it happen.
We're going to start training right now. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Thank you so much for your time and hope we can do this again.
All right. Thanks, Cam.
You bet. Cameron Haynes joining us here, a professional bow hunter. And again, make sure you check out NRA All Access on Outdoor Channel at 8:30 Wednesday, March 23rd for Cameron's episode. Now, when we come back, Bob Owens, I'm going to have to train hard to get to the point where I would not embarrass myself in front of Cameron Haynes. Bob Owens of Bearing Arms is going to join us on the program. Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCor Defense. Deal of the Day, good guy as well. All coming up at the top of the hour. Stick around. We have much more. NRA News, Cam and Company, coming up right after this. Thank you both, by the way, for your service and all that you've done. So tell me, how did you get involved with the Warrior Angels Foundation?
Well, Andrew and I have actually known each other for at least 15 years. We went to high school together, so we grew up together in a lot of ways. But I served in a 3rd Ranger Battalion in the Army, and after my deployment to northern Iraq, came back, and during the training operation, I suffered a traumatic brain injury. My parachute didn't open fully, so therefore I was then medically discharged from the Army, and shortly after being discharged, I was drugged up incredibly, and within about 18 months, my entire life just started to spiral downward.
I'd like to ask you guys, I mean, there's certainly been a lot of controversy over the Veterans Administration, the VA hospital system. I want to focus, though, really how that applies to this particular issue.
Right.
You know, the VA, for all of its other problems, generally is regarded pretty as a pretty high-quality provider for very specific battle-type, service-related injuries, service-related illnesses. Why do you think they haven't quite got a grasp on PTSD? Because this has been something that has obviously been an issue, really, going back to the Vietnam War, which is when we started really seeing a lot of these cases come back.
You have to really look at what is
post-traumatic stress, and you have to look at traumatic brain injury. What we're now finding out is the majority of people are massively misdiagnosed with post-traumatic stress. By definition, post-traumatic stress is purely a behavioral and psychological issue. So if there is any physical trauma in that person's timeline, by definition, it can't be post-traumatic stress. So the first thing we need to look at is traumatic brain injury. And that's when we go and we say, okay, well, let's do an independent objective analysis of his blood to see where he's at. And we can then see, okay, this person is deficient in these very important neurosteroids that are responsible for making us who we are. Cognition, behavior, our physiology, our psychology, everything is wrapped up in it. And so if that is messed up and it's deficient and it's not working correctly, now we're going to have all these declines that we see in somebody's behavior. And it happens, it can happen slowly. It can happen during a day, a week, a month, a year after the injury. And so when that happens and a person starts having issues, they can't tie it to any one event. And they're going to the doctor and they're saying, I don't know what's happening, but I think I'm going crazy, and I don't have any reason to. And instead of doing their due diligence, the medical system, they say, okay, great, you're going on packet number A of drugs. And when that doesn't work 3 months later, we'll up it and put you on packet B. So if you say you're depressed and you're put on antidepressants and you're still depressed, then that's probably not what's wrong.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's where we are in the system. So the good news is, We weren't going to wait around for the government to solve it. My family didn't have the time. We have people in need. So we went out and found an alternative means, and we're disrupting the entire system.
That's great. I mean, is the VA listening now?
We've been in conversations with the highest echelons of the VA, and they're not going to have a choice. It's going to be one of two things. It's either going to go, they're going to have to accept it, or the current technology is going to advance so much that it'll democratize and dematerialize the current healthcare system. Where, right. You know, it's like, hey, do whatever you want. We can get this groundbreaking therapy, whether you want to pay for it or not.
Talking again with Andrew Marr, the CEO and founder of the Warrior Angels Foundation, and Chase Rowan as well with community relations for the foundation. So how do you folks raise funds, Andrew? What do you do to...
We're a 501c3, so we're a nonprofit organization. So we function off people's generosity. And the way I look at it is... an investment. You're investing in somebody's life. We've now been able to treat over 100 veterans. Many were on a multitude of medications and had more than one attempt at suicide. And majority of our guys are completely off all medications and back and living life again.
Wow. That is amazing.
So we're just bringing the results and letting people understand what's out there and saying, hey, if this is a value to you, and it is to us, then this is a great way for you to be able to give back.
Well, listen, again, we cannot thank you enough for everything that you've done for this country, and thank you again
it's
for everything you continue
to do. It's on our website, Chase, www.waftbi.org. We have a plethora of information on there, put out a ton of stuff on brain health, all the social media. We're the cool kids with social media these days, so we're on all the hot links, and we're putting out, dropping knowledge bombs left and right.
Andrew, listen, thank you so much for coming by. It's a real pleasure.
Pleasure's ours.
Chase, thank you as well, sir.
Thanks, guys.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Look there at the Media Row in Farmville, WBHL, Farmville Herald. Can't quite see the NRA News studios in that picture, but we're not too far away there on, we're not on Media Row, we're on Main Street. There in the former Armory building, Jim Jakes of Bearing Arms, you know, was with us in studio on Monday. We got to get Bob Owens of Bearing Arms up here, especially Bob, now that spring has sprung and the weather's not too bad, roads shouldn't be too bad from North Carolina. We got to have you in studio here one afternoon.
I think we could probably swing that.
All right, good. Well, let's make that happen in the near future. How are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear it. We're still looking at Georgia and campus carry. Lawmakers, I guess tomorrow is the last day of the legislative session. Lawmakers say they don't plan on passing any of the bills that Governor Nathan Deal had suggested as improvements to the campus carry legislation. Meaning that it's basically, it looks like at this point, Bob, up to Governor Deal as to whether or not he's going to sign campus carry or he's going to veto it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see which way he's going to go on that, not getting precisely what he wants. hopefully he will go with a, you know they say that politics is kind of like making sausage. You want to see how it happens.
Right.
Hopefully he'll take the good over the perfect, and we'll sign the bill.
Yeah, let's hope. I know that there have been a lot of gun owners in Georgia calling the governor's office. Again, I say if you're the parent of a college student there in Georgia, make that call as well. And, you know, in the meantime, Bob, some of the biggest news I think this week has come not from state capitals, but from the U.S. Supreme Court. Despite the absence of Justice Antonin Scalia, the court unanimously, in a case dealing with a stun gun ban out of Massachusetts, told the Supreme Judicial Court there in the state of Massachusetts, hey, go back and read the Heller decision because you're getting it completely wrong. We said it is laughable to claim that only weapons that were around in 1789 are protected by the Second Amendment, and that's exactly what the court did. This was a fairly strong decision by the Supreme Court, and I think that the scope of this could go well beyond this particular case.
I completely agree. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court made an absolutely absurd argument. You know, it was right up there with Piers Musket Morgan, you know, trying to say that, you know, only those guns that were in existence from 1791 were included. Well, that's fine, Judge. Turn in your computer, go back to parchment and a quill pen to write your decisions, because that's all the technology they had back for the First Amendment. It was a silly ruling by a not serious court that was trying to impose their personal will as opposed to reinforcing the constitutionality of the law. And so, yeah, and I agree with you. This could have much wider implications. The founding fathers, if you bother to read what they wrote and what they said about the right to bear arms, they did not mean it for hunting. They did not mean it for even personal defense. They wanted the citizenry armed with military weapons so that they could fight enemies foreign or domestic, including their own government. And if you look at what they wanted and you bring it forward to a modern context, it's very hard to argue that they would not be in favor of AR-15s and AK-47s. And real fully automatic weapons as well, because those are precisely the weapons that a modern militia unit would use in combat.
You know, Justice Alito had a concurring opinion that Justice Thomas signed on to as well, and he kind of elaborated. Now, again, he's not talking for the entire Supreme Court. He's speaking for himself and Justice Thomas, but, you know, he kind of talked about a test and what sort of test would look like. And he said, in essence, you know, look, if well, let's see here. Heller defined arms covered by the Second Amendment to include, quote, anything that a man wears for his defense or takes into his hands or useth in wrath to cast at or strike another. Under the decision below, however, talking about the Catano case out of Massachusetts, virtually every covered firearm would qualify as dangerous. So he was talking about, you know, what constitutes dangerous, what constitutes unusual. And he says the pertinent Second Amendment inquiry is whether stun guns are commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes today. The pertinent Second Amendment inquiry is whether X are commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes today. In this case, it's stun guns, but that seems to be the test that Justice Alito suggests it should be the test of every related case. Are semi-automatic rifles commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes today? Are magazines over 10 rounds commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes today? You know, Bob, I mean, again, this to me, I think, is the clearest articulation that we've seen from the court since Heller, or at least a member of the court since Heller, as to what that test should be. We've had all of these courts saying, well, is it intermediate scrutiny? Is it strict scrutiny? Most of them say it should be intermediate scrutiny. You know, there are a lot of things that should be allowed to stand. Here you have Justice Alito saying, no, it's really pretty simple, and here's what I think it should be.
Yeah, and it's a pretty strong argument that I think he makes here. We're looking at, you know, weapons in common use, which would include every handgun that I can think of, you know, as far as semi-automatics, revolvers, and things, you know, derringers, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be looking at pump action, bolt action, and semi-automatic rifles and shotguns, because those are all in very common use. They've been around since 1885. It's really hard to picture what would not be included in that. And the only thing I could probably think of, under his interpretation, would be potentially automatic weapons, especially heavy caliber weapons, which would not be very easy to carry anyway. I don't see anybody carrying a 20-millimeter Lottie down the street for personal defense. But pretty much, if you can buy it in a normal gun store, you should probably be able to use it.
You know, again, a fairly simple test, as you say. And he noted, he explained it a little bit further. He said, the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts offered only a cursory discussion of this question, whether stun guns are commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes today, noting that the, quote, number of tasers and stun guns is dwarfed by the number of firearms. And Justice Alito said, this observation may be true, but it's beside the point. Otherwise, a state would be free to ban all weapons except handguns because, quoting Heller, handguns are the most popular weapon chosen by Americans for self-defense in the home. He said the more relevant statistic is that, quote, hundreds of thousands of tasers and stun guns have been sold to private citizens who, it appears, may lawfully possess them in 45 states. Now, that's the more relevant statistic, according to Justice Alito and Justice Thomas. Well, again, you know, you look at that Fourth Circuit challenge to the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, Bob. You know, look, you've got millions of semi-automatic rifles that have been sold to law-abiding private citizens for lawful purposes all around the country, and it is the most popular style of rifle in the country today.
Absolutely. I mean, the vast majority of firearms that have been sold will be judged legal if you look at strict scrutiny and you look at original intent. And, you know, it's the whole living constitution, excuse me, that some on the far left are trying to push is the only way to keep many of these laws alive, because they simply do not come close to passing the sniff test if you look at them with strict scrutiny, as all individual rights in the Bill of Rights should be looked at.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. I wonder, you know, frankly, I don't think that we'll see confirmation hearings for Merrick Garland. But I wonder if going forward, you know, during any future confirmation hearings, if the Alito test will be brought up. You know, Justice Alito has said, here's what they think, here's what he thinks the test should be when it comes to determining whether a firearm is constitutionally protected or a weapon is constitutionally protected. What say you? Wouldn't you love to get a poll of judges, even just a poll of sitting judges right now, Bob, answering anonymously? Wouldn't you love to see how many justices and judges agree with that position?
Well, and it would be a fairly, I mean, it's a very obvious and I think a very fair test of how well do you understand the Constitution. And so I think it would be incumbent upon any future Senate for any potential justice to ask them that very question. You know, these are core constitutional rights. More important than that, they're natural rights. They predate the Constitution. So, if they cannot uphold core human rights, which is what the right to bear arms is, then they should have no business on the Supreme Court of the United States or any other court for that matter.
Bob Owens of Bearing Arms. Listen, buddy, we are almost out of time this hour, but I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Enjoy, hopefully, some warm weather this weekend. Maybe even get out to the range, possibly?
Only if they have one in Orlando.
I think they probably do, but if you're going to be in Orlando, I'm guessing you probably already have weekend plans.
I do.
Well, enjoy yourself in Orlando, Florida. That sounds fantastic. I hope we get a chance to talk to you soon.
All right. Take care, my friend.
All right. You too. Bob Owens of Bearing Arms joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. We've got the deal of the day, good guy of the day, and, of course, a hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, coming up at the start of Hour 3, J.D. Tuchilli of Reason, on Australia's gun buyback, you know, the one that's so popular with President Obama and Hillary Clinton. Yeah, they don't really talk much about the violent firearms black market that the buyback created. I mean, I can understand why they'd want to downplay that, but J.D.'s written a whole column about it, and why would the United States want to do what Australia did? Again, President Obama, Hillary Clinton, they keep praising this buyback without talking about the downside. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media joins us on the program as well next hour. And before we run out of time here, just quickly, you know, we talked about what Justice Alito and Justice Thomas concurred with in the opinion in the Catano case dealing with the stun guns in Massachusetts and the test that Justice Alito said should be laid out. Now, the actual per curia opinion by the Supreme Court did not get that specific, but here's what they did say. The court, talking about the Massachusetts High Court, they said offered three explanations to support its holding that the Second Amendment does not extend to stun guns. First, they said that stun guns are not protected because they're not in common use at the time of the Second Amendment's enactment. The court unanimously said this is inconsistent with Heller's clear statement that the Second Amendment, quote, extends to arms that were not in existence at the time of the founding. So then they asked whether stun guns are dangerous per se, at common law, and unusual in an attempt to apply one, quote, important limitation on the right to keep and carry arms from Heller, referring to the, quote, historical tradition of prohibiting the carrying of dangerous and unusual weapons. But the court concluded that stun guns are unusual because they are a, quote, thoroughly modern invention. By equating unusual with in common use at the time of the Second Amendment's enactment, the court's second explanation is the same as the first, and it is also still inconsistent with Heller. Finally, they said the court used a contemporary lens and found, quote, nothing in the record to suggest that stun guns are readily adaptable to use in the military. But, the court points out, again unanimously, Heller rejected the proposition that, quote, only those weapons useful in warfare are protected. And the court said, for these three reasons, the explanation the Massachusetts court offered for upholding the law contradicts this court's precedent. So they didn't talk about a test, but they did make some important acknowledgments. And we'll touch on those again after a quick timeout. Stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nozzles, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Jonathan Rockin with the Shooting Club. Jonathan, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Great. I'm fantastic. Good to be here.
Well, you got a cool product. We were talking a little bit the other day, and I had to grab you guys over to talk about it. Tell me what is, and tell everyone else, what is the Shooting Club?
The Shooting Club is the world's first smartphone app that connects shooters across the country in competition for cash and prizes while promoting gun safety. We found that accidents happen with guns because people aren't proficient with them. They sit in a drawer. They don't know how to use them. Maybe you've been to a shooting range once or twice, but if you're rusty, it doesn't really matter. So we found that if we can find a way to reward people and make it fun and give away money, then people will take it a little bit more seriously. So we have a proprietary handicapping system which allows shooters who are very new beginners all the way up to retired cops and military to compete against one another on a fair playing field.
Dude, what a great concept. So, all right, so I got a lot of questions for you here. How before we go to how does it work, how did it go from this, hey, I got this great idea, to something that you're just getting ready to launch now in the App Store?
The whole idea started two Thanksgivings ago. My dad and I were talking. I was visiting him out in Houston, Texas, and he had commented he just got a new handgun, and his brother, who lives in Louisiana, had gotten one also. And they were trash-talking a little bit about who's a better shot. And he said, wouldn't it be cool if there was a website where we could upload pictures of our targets and see who's a better shot? My regular business and my background is in web development and design, and I said, you know what, that's a really good idea. We looked and we looked, and there was nothing like that out there. So we decided to build it ourselves. Two years later, here we are.
Wow, that is so cool. All right, so it's called the Shooting Club. How does it work?
So you download the free app from the iPhone store or from the Google Play store.
Got it.
And you find a local range using GPS on your phone if you've never been to a range. At the local range, you purchase one of our official competition targets. You scan the QR code, and then you take the target, which is very, very unique and fun, which is really the secret sauce of what we do. It's really four targets in one. You shoot it according to the rules. You use the app itself, which uses your native camera to take a picture, scores it, handicaps you, and uploads it into your activity feed so all your friends and followers and fellow gun lovers can see your scores.
That is so awesome. What a great idea.
You can even form private groups that are just for maybe a couple of buddies that are for your own private competitions as well.
And I'll tell you what, Jonathan, we're always talking about here in NRA News how important it is to keep the shooting sports and hunting and everything related to that, the Second Amendment, everything related, keep it vibrant, keep it growing, keep it relevant. And what a great way to do this, to actually be able to merge. Because the biggest thing is people get so caught up in technology, they actually don't go out and shoot anymore. But this merges technology with going out and shooting.
And it makes it social. We found that if you have a buddy that lives in another state and you both love to shoot, but you never have a chance to go together to a range and make it a social activity, now we've removed the geographic and the time borders to do that.
Big.
As you follow people, you can post your stuff to Facebook. You can form your own private groups, upload pictures. Hey, I just got a brand new 9mm. I can't wait to try it out, etc. And what we found is this is bringing in some of the growing interest groups, such as women and millennials, who are newer to shooting sports, and it gives them a platform to really take it and run
right,
with it.
Before we run out of time, how do we get more information about the shooting
club? You can go to theshootingclub.com or look for the app, The Shooting Club, in your app store.
Jonathan Rocket, The Shooting Club, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News.
You bet. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. J.D. Tuchilli of Reason Magazine coming up later on in the hour. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media joining us as well. Had an email talking about the Massachusetts case, the Catano case, dealing with stun guns. This was from Robert in Westfield, Massachusetts, who had apparently asked Jim Wallace. All right, so could this have any applicability, the Supreme Court decision, to the Massachusetts approved firearm list? And Jim said, probably not. You know, these things, the courts look at these things very, very specifically. So you'd have to have a specific legal challenge. You'd have to raise this as an argument that this, what the Supreme Court said, should apply to things other than stun guns, whatever it is that you would be challenging there in Massachusetts or around the country. But, you know, again, it provides a new legal argument, Robert, because there are more words now from the court that we can discuss beyond the Heller case, beyond the McDonald case. There is now the per curiae decision, again, unanimously from the Supreme Court. Now, you could also reference Justice Alito's concurring opinion signed on to by Justice Thomas, but that doesn't have the weight of the court, right? Those are the opinions of the individual justices. So we know at least two of the eight members of the court agree with that position. So the court itself, you know, in that per curiae decision, as I read to you right before the break, they didn't say anything about a test. They didn't get into what the test should be. They didn't talk about intermediate scrutiny. They didn't talk about strict scrutiny. They specifically objected to the line of reasoning that the Supreme Judicial Court had taken in determining that stun guns were not constitutionally protected under the Second Amendment. And they didn't have to approach intermediate scrutiny or strict scrutiny. They didn't have to get into those details. They didn't have to talk about what the test should be, because they could rely on what had previously been said in Heller and McDonald to point out, here's where you're wrong. So these are still open questions before the Supreme Court. And just because we got this per curiae decision in the Catano case out of Massachusetts saying that stun guns absolutely are protected under the Second Amendment doesn't mean that we have eight votes on the Supreme Court who would say the same thing about a semi-automatic firearm or a magazine over 10 rounds. Far from it, as a matter of fact. You know, again, Justice Alito talked about the reluctance of the court to reach this conclusion, which suggests that this was at least a somewhat heavy lift for those justices who thought that the court should take the position that it ultimately took, that there was a discussion, probably a disagreement, legal arguments bandied about back and forth. Again, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to have seen and heard that debate, but we know it was not something that they just simply, you know, show of hands and they all agreed. Justice Alito at least let us know that much. So, you know, again, I think going forward with where the court is right now, and where the court could be, this just underscores how important these elections are and how important the placement of the next justice on the United Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, will be. All right, let's get to our hero of the day our deal of the day and our good guy today. The hero of the day comes from the Seattle Times. A shooting at an apartment complex this Sunday morning. Headline, one dead, one wounded in Renton apartment complex shooting. Now you get into the story, police say an armed intruder shot the lock off a door to an apartment and killed a man inside just before 6:30 in the morning on Sunday. A woman in the apartment retrieved her own gun and returned fire, wounding the intruder. The exchange of gunfire happened at the Plumtree Park Apartments, according to Renton Police Detective Robert Onishi. Police arrived at the apartment complex. They found the intruder critically wounded in the parking lot. They transported him to Harborview Medical Center. Both victims actually transported there to Harborview in Seattle. The intruder underwent emergency surgery, remained in critical condition as of Sunday afternoon. The resident of the apartment, again, was unfortunately killed. Police say that all three were in their 30s. They all appear to have known each other. Police say the woman in the apartment is not under arrest and is not facing any charges, but apparently was able to protect herself from a killer thanks to her ability to get to a firearm. We'll try to keep our eyes on that story and give you any updates if and when they become available. Our deal of the day today from the Kokomo Tribune in Kokomo, Indiana. The accused killer of a Howard County Sheriff's deputy. Man with a long criminal history, according to the Kokomo Tribune. Carl Kuntz was fatally shot. And police say 25-year-old Evan Dorsey was the man who did it. Kokomo Tribune says Dorsey began exhibiting criminal behavior shortly after his 18th birthday, with a slew of drug offenses and one violent incident to his name. Dorsey owned a long rap sheet, one that included 8 criminal cases in 6 different counties. He's 25. Kicked off his criminal career, they report, as an 18-year-old when he was arrested in Montgomery County for battery resulting in bodily injury and possession of paraphernalia less than a month before, or a month after his birthday. Kokomo Tribune says following that first arrest, however, Dorsey's violent side would largely stay hidden. From that point on, he was arrested mostly for drug and alcohol-related charges. Charged with his first felonies on January 30th, 2014 in Clinton County, Indiana, a case, the paper says, that would ultimately prove fatal for both himself and Deputy Kuntz. After being arrested on 2 Class D felonies, possession of a controlled substance and unlawful possession of a syringe, he was sentenced on both charges in Clinton County Circuit Court in February 2014 to the Indiana Department of Correction for 18 months, with 2 months executed and 16 months suspended to probation. Officials from the Indiana Department of Corrections could not be contacted, the paper says, about whether Dorsey actually spent time in state prison or served the time in county jail. So that was January 30th, 2014. 2 months behind bars, 16 months on probation. By January of 2015, just a year later, Dorsey was convicted of violating his probation. He got served a warrant on December 30th, 2015. Almost a year later. When he missed a court date on January 6, 2016, a failure to appear warrant was issued. This led officers to Rushville Sunday morning, where they had previously learned that Dorsey was likely hiding out in a trailer park. Kokomo Tribune says it was there that Dorsey, instead of facing that failure to appear warrant, shot and killed the sheriff's deputy, Carl Kuntz, injured Sergeant Jordan Buckley, and then killed himself. Could this suspect have been behind bars instead of on the run? Evan Dorsey, 25 years old, and a lengthy criminal record. Not a lot of time behind bars to show for it. today's deal of the day. Our good guy of the day. From the website Channel 3000, the story not of a law enforcement officer, but a citizen helping the law enforcement community. Evansville, Wisconsin, Maria Messling. She's in fifth grade. Back in November, there was an officer, Ryan Copeland. Who passed away. He died in a car accident. And Maria, at the time, was raising money for Officer Copeland and his dog, Boris, who's a canine officer. She had raised $100 on her own. And was raising even more when Officer Copeland passed away. She was raising this money through a program called Wisconsin Vest a Dog. So volunteers raise money for vests for canines. After Officer Copeland's death, Maria Messling said she wanted to keep up with the program. She never got a chance to meet the officer. Boris did get his vest, but she never got to meet Officer Copeland. So she kept at it this year. And she had a goal. She wanted to raise enough money to get another vest for another canine officer. Started out trying to raise money for a vest for Ali, who's a canine officer who works with Officer Kyle Dabbs in Maple Bluff, Wisconsin. Then she asked for help from her school, Theodore Robinson Intermediate School in Evansville, Wisconsin. And the students responded in a big way. They helped raise $1,850, which will provide a vest not only for Ali, but perhaps one other canine officer as well. They've actually doubled the amount of funds that they need to purchase a vest, so it looks like two canine officers and their human counterparts will benefit from the actions of Maria Messling, the fifth graders there at Theodore Robinson Intermediate School in Evansville, Wisconsin. And so we thank Maria. We thank those kids for being some of the many, many good guys out there. All right, J.D. Giucilli of Reason will join us on the program in just a little bit. Steven Cruiser of PJ Media. Cameron Gray sent me a story here. I'm reluctant, Cameron, to address this story because it's from Gawker. And it's Gawker.
Well, they'll be out of business soon, so give them a break.
Give them a plug there. They could use the traffic, I suppose.
That's right.
So Gawker, is this Sam Biddle? Is that who it is? I think it's Sam Biddle at Gawker. Has a piece, why would ISIS attack our subways with gas when we have all these convenient guns? And shouldn't we ban all these guns? Is basically the gist of the story there from Sam. Quote, if the government really wants to protect us from another Paris, they'll reconsider releasing inert genetic samples into the air and instead consider making it as difficult as possible to buy devices that allow instant, effortless murder. Sam's all on board with gun bans, apparently. What's fascinating is that Sam, who also writes in this piece, the Second Amendment, at least as it is currently interpreted by our courts and understood by our lawmakers, is a would-be terrorist's best friend. Sam also quotes the command by ISIS after the attacks in Paris. He said, or ISIS said, use anything that you can, including a rock, right? A rock to bash in the heads of your enemies. that the, in other words, the tool is one part of the equation, but what you really need to have is the desire to kill. However you can. That was the command. That was the edict laid down by ISIS. And here is Sam saying, well, you know, if we just ban this stuff over here, we ban that stuff over there, and we keep banning stuff, then eventually we'll ban our way to safety. We have seen, again, in Europe, ISIS terrorists have had no problem circumventing the European gun laws. They've had no problem obtaining explosive material and things like nails that they intentionally placed within these suitcase bombs to cause as much damage and devastation and death as possible. Do you really think you're going to ban your way to safety here? You know, I guess Sam does. Or Sam thinks that this is a fantastic opportunity to once again just, you know, call for more gun control laws. But you will not ban your way to safety. We cannot ban our way to safety. Because it's not an untold number of inanimate objects that are bound and determined to try to kill as many innocent people as possible. It's living, breathing human beings who are doing that. And efforts that ignore the obvious problem and the obvious source of that death and destruction, those efforts are doomed to failure if the goal is to try to protect us. Now, again, if the goal is to try to disarm us instead, because, hey, you know, they can try. That's a pretty good argument, I suppose. But most people aren't really calling for disarmament these days, are they? Not with the concealed carry courses full up months in advance. The number of applications at record highs in a lot of states. No, it appears that many, many more Americans are more interested in protecting themselves than giving up their right to keep and bear arms. All right, when we come back, J.D. Tuccilli of Reason talking about the Australian gun buyback. You know, it's highly regarded by people like President Obama and Hillary Clinton. But J.D. says it also created a violent firearms black market. So why on earth would we want to do that here? Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Jim Sapieca, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, there's three museums. Let's talk about that third museum you guys have way out west.
That third museum is kind of a little hidden jewel box. It doesn't get the press that the other two bigger museums get, but it's a spectacular little display case. It's the Frank Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and it's at the NRA Whittington Center in Raton, New Mexico. Now, folks who are really shooters will know what the Whittington Center is, but those who may not be that active, it's a spectacular range and hunting complex that is owned and operated by the NRA. There are tens of thousands of acres out there with spectacular ranges where a lot of different championship matches are shot in addition to general recreational and sporting shooting. But they also have the Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and they have some great guns there. Of course, that history of that area is just spectacular, going back to the conquistadors. And they follow the evolution of firearms in that area throughout that multiple century span. They also have firearms that are used in the types of competitions that take place at the Whittington Center. And they recently got a spectacular group of modern engraved firearms. There are masterworks there that I have never seen the likes of before. So if you're in that area, and it's a great area for vacationing, there's a lot of attractions in that area, be sure you don't miss this little jewel box of a museum there.
And how do you get to see all the museums online?
Well, you can. We have several social media platforms. We've got, of course, the website, nramuseums.com. And, of course, we have our Facebook page. You can friend us there and get our Gun of the Day posts. So you can visit us on the Internet, Facebook, get the books. And for sure, come by and see the three museums. They're all open every day of the week, and admission is always free.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, listen up. You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends, but you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland, where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. That's what it takes. You haven't met the steel workers and the hard rock miners or the swamp folks in Cajun country who can wrestle a full-grown gator out of the water. You haven't met the farmers, the cowboys, the loggers, and the truck drivers. You don't know the mountain men who live off the land or the brave cops who fight the good fight in the urban war zones. No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
You know the threat is real. You sit in meetings with advisors and operatives who tell you there could be Islamic sleeper cells in every major American community. You know the southern border is a welcome mat for terrorists to enter our towns and neighborhoods at will. You know about their plots to kill us in our shopping malls, our sports stadiums, and our office buildings. You won your office by talking like a champion of freedom. Now it's time to act like one. Pass a national right to carry law that guarantees my constitutional right to defend myself, my family, and my fellow Americans anywhere inside our borders. And make sure the enemies of freedom know the power of freedom. No law-abiding American should be forced to face evil with empty hands. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Steven Cruiser of PJ Media coming up in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome to the program, writing at Reason, J.D. Chuchilli. J.D., how you doing, sir?
Doing well. Glad to be here.
It's good to talk with you once again. I appreciate you coming on the program. And as I mentioned, you know, we have heard just glowing reports about Australia's gun buyback, quote-unquote, their compensated confiscation program. Hillary Clinton sounds like she's fully on board with it. Barack Obama loves it. He's talked about it several times. But you know, there's always the sort of partial telling of what happened in Australia with the change in gun laws. And you've got a piece at Reason saying that the quote-unquote buyback, yeah, it took a lot of guns away from people, but it also created a violent firearms black market.
It absolutely did. I mean, at first, let's acknowledge Australia is a great country, you know, a wonderful place, wonderful people, and it's also a peaceful country. But it was peaceful long before they had that big 1996 gun buyback. They had a homicide rate of about 1.8 per 100,000 people. Then they did this gun buyback, which gets ballyhooed as somehow the great policy that should be pursued by people like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And afterwards, they had roughly the same gun homicide rate, and it had been declining for years. So it switched downward for years after the buyback. But the buyback, first of all, obviously didn't have a big impact on the statistics. And second, it couldn't have because a lot of Australians didn't pay any attention to it. The Sporting Shooters Association of Australia estimates about 19% compliance. I found an Austrian criminologist who estimated 20% compliance. Most Australians ignored it. So a lot of the guns that were supposed to be turned in were never turned in. Couldn't have had a major impact. Since then, though, they've had their motorcycle gangs are rising to take the position of our mafia, the way our mafia did during Prohibition. It's rising to satisfy the demand for drugs and for guns. They're smuggling guns in. They're manufacturing their own machine guns. I mean, the stories from Australia are amazing about Mac-10s being manufactured by these machinists in their backyards and turning out, you know, quite a number of them. And they've got a violent subculture there that really hasn't impacted the overall crime rate. They're still, by and large, a peaceful country,
but with an increasingly violent subculture that's paying no attention to their gun laws, hasn't been impacted by them, except to find a new market for something to sell, which is illegal firearms to other criminals. So they have a subculture problem with crime. They've got a violent black market there for guns that hasn't yet crept into the mainstream culture of a country that was peaceful before the gun buyback, remain peaceful afterwards, and has that peace without regard to their gun policies.
You know, and it's interesting because you're right. You see the stories of the bikey gangs, and you actually see, J.D., if you cover, you know, the gun control issue, you see stories out of Australia where people are saying, listen, that what we did back in the 90s, they didn't go far enough. We have to go further. So while President Obama, Hillary Clinton are, you know, touting what Australia did as some big success story, politicians in Australia are saying, nah, we really didn't have the impact that we think we need to have. We need to go bigger in terms of our gun control plans.
Well, this is the constant politician complaint, too, is that either they should be accredited with all the good in the world, or else the policy that they had that failed just needs to be done harder to the people in order to accomplish the goal they said they wanted to accomplish. Mm-hmm. They're never going to admit that they actually empowered the criminal element in their society by handing them this vast new market for smuggling, manufacturing, and then selling firearms, along with the drugs that they already were handling beforehand, and that they've turned these motorcycle gangs into a new mafia for Australia, which is exactly what they've done. Again, the average Australian really hasn't been touched too much by this. They generally have a peaceful country, but they're creating the preconditions for a much bigger problem by empowering this black market and empowering organized crime.
So once you've started down this road, J.D., and you've said this is how we're going to deal with a violent crime, this is how we're going to deal with a horrific killing like the Port Arthur massacre, we're going to go ahead and we're going to try to make it harder for law-abiding people to own firearms. We're going to buy back, quote-unquote, a lot of the guns that are already owned. I mean, how do you reverse course? How easy is it for a state to say, never mind? As you say, what you're writing here suggests that it is very hard for a state to acknowledge a mistake and to actually reverse course, that instead we keep going, we tend to keep going down this dead-end road.
Well, the best thing for them to do is probably to address that imbalance of power now between the criminal element and the peaceful people. To a certain extent, Australians are doing that already. Their gun ownership rate returned to the pre-buyback levels. New South Wales has got just a surge in gun ownership in the suburban areas around Sydney, because Sydney does have a growing crime problem. So Australians themselves are – now, you're not allowed to say I'm buying a gun for self-defense in Australia. So they're purchasing guns in the suburbs around the main cities there, and I'm sure they're saying they want to go target shooting or hunting. So they're trying to address that themselves. But Australia, on a policy level, needs to recognize that they've empowered criminals and disempowered peaceful citizens. They need to redress that, I would say, by allowing peaceful citizens the means to self-defense, if they so choose, and then take away the black market and the money and power it brings to the criminal gangs by legalizing the ownership of civilian weapons, or further legalizing. It's not fully outlawed there by any means, but by further legalizing the use of guns for self-defense and just easing the ownership rules.
You know, you write in your piece at Reason, once you enable organized crime, there are no boundaries, right? And you point out that Australia's criminal gangs aren't just supplying pistols, but, ten rocket launchers that have gone missing, and the police only recovered one of them, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're a criminal organization, you don't stop at what the civilian arms were beforehand. Civilians might want to buy bolt-action hunting rifles or SKS rifles or whatever it might be. But if you're going, fully illegal, the sky's the limit. So their backyard mechanics aren't knocking out bolt-action rifles. They're knocking out submachine guns. And when they steal, a major source of weapons for the organized crime gangs there is the military. They pressure military officers who have access to the arms stores, and they get access to things, and they have actually gained access to shoulder-fired rocket launchers. I mean, it's absolutely amazing the weapons they get, but that's because it's a black market run by organized crime. So they're not going to stop short on civilian arms. They're just going to be the sky's the limit. And that sky now is submachine guns for drive-by shootings and rocket launchers for whatever use. I can't even imagine what they would use those for, but they're criminals. They'll find a purpose.
Well, that's the thing. So let's talk about the United States here for a second. Yesterday on the program, I was reading a report by a DEA official to the House Oversight Committee in Congress. He was talking about the heroin epidemic in the United States. And he said that, over the past 20 years, heroin has become more potent. It's become cheaper in the United States, and a lot of that is because the Mexican drug cartels are now they're cultivating poppy fields in Mexico. They're plowing under the marijuana plants. They're growing more poppy plants. They have decided they have seen a market, and they are taking it. If JD, we ever decided, you know what? Let's do what we did in what they did in Australia. Let's just wipe the Second Amendment out of the Bill of Rights entirely. It is absurd to think that there are no multinational criminal organizations out there who would not both be willing and able to step up and fill any sort of gap that criminals in the United States might find in terms of firearms availability. There are 100-plus nations around the country, including nations like China and Iran and Russia, who are exporting firearms via the black market. They would find their way to the United States very quickly, I might add.
Oh, very easily. And we've already seen weapons that we supplied to guerrilla groups in Central America reappearing in the hands of the drug gangs, the drug cartels in Mexico. I mean, full automatic machine guns, rocket launchers used in their gangs too, hand grenades. I mean, that's not stuff you buy in a Texas gun store. That's stuff that came from the U.S. military, supplied to some group in Central America 15, 20 years ago, forgotten about, and then crept its way back north. We have a huge military. All you need to do is find some soldiers with gambling problems or that want some extra money or have a drug issue, and you're going to have access to the arms stores in the military like it's happening in Australia. And, of course, they can manufacture their own, as they're doing in Australia. They'll set up, mechanics, shops wherever they want to and knock them out. But this is not a hard kind of a device to manufacture, to smuggle, and to supply. And as long as there's demand for it, somebody is going to supply it. It can be supplied by a normal, peaceful, legal market, or it can be supplied by a criminal market that has no boundaries to it.
You know, and so you get into, I think, one of the very key points in how we actually do fight violent crime, because you talked about the demand as opposed to the supply, right? I mean, we live in a nation with somewhere between 300 and 400 million privately owned firearms. We have far, far fewer criminals than that. And as you know, JD, preponderance of violent crime is committed in most communities by a fairly minute number of individuals. When you look at it from that perspective, to me, it makes no sense to think for an instance that the primary way or the most effective way or an effective way to combat violent crime is to go after legal gun owners. I mean, you have to go after the people who are committing the violent crimes, and you can start again with those with, you know, lengthy violent criminal histories, and try to change their behavior either through the carrot or the stick. But you don't impact violent criminals in Baltimore, Maryland by passing a semi-auto ban across the entire state of Maryland.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, you really don't need that many guns in circulation to supply all of the armed robbers and drug dealers and muggers. In countries that have very tight controls actually develop very sophisticated markets for supplying the criminals. They'll actually have criminals that do nothing but rent guns to other criminals. If it gets used in a crime, then there's a deposit that gets taken away. The gun is now sold. If it's not actually fired, then it's just a rental, and the gun gets returned to be rented out to the next criminal. The markets are unbelievably sophisticated, and you don't need that much to supply them to these criminals who then prey upon the population at large. So you can try to limit, access to guns by the civilians, the peaceful people, but you're never going to keep them out of the hands of the hardcore criminals who are the real danger to society at large.
Talking to you with J.D. Tuccilli, the recent piece at Reason Magazine on Australia's gun buyback. J.D., listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's always a pleasure getting a chance to talk with you. Hope we can do it again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. J.D. Tuccilli with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. The criminal markets are unbelievably sophisticated, J.D. says. And the anti-gun rhetoric is unbelievably simple. Right? More guns equals more crime, they say. I mean, that is the foundational dogmatic premise of the anti-gun movement, that more guns must equal more crime, so if we have less guns, we'll have less crime. Even reality doesn't bear that out. I mean, you don't even have to look at some sort of theory here. You can just look at what's happened in this country over the past 20 years. We've had a lot more guns in circulation. We've had a lot more gun owners. We've seen the rise of right to carry. We have over 13 million concealed carry holders in the country right now. What's happened to the crime rate? 2015, looks like we might have seen an increase in the last 6 months of 2015. Looks like crime might be going up in 2016. That's happened in a couple of years over the past 20 years where crime has ticked back up. But we have seen, generally speaking, a trend to the point that we are at 40-year lows, 50-year lows, all-time lows in some communities in terms of violent crime. You know, again, the foundational dogmatic premise of the anti-gun movement has been proven wrong. But they can't get away from it. Got to keep saying. Say it often enough. Maybe they'll. Maybe someone will believe it. More guns equals more crime. Even when it's demonstrably untrue. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we come back, Stephen Kruiser of PJ Media is going to join us on the program. We'll talk about some of the big stories of the day. In addition to the latest news from Brussels, Belgium, we now have word from the Obama administration that, some individuals that have been released from Guantanamo Bay have gone on to harm Americans again. You know, there's always going to be a recidivism rate, right? I mean, there's always going to be some people you just can't turn around. Senior Defense Department official telling lawmakers today Americans have been killed by prisoners released from the detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, triggering sharp criticism from Republicans opposed to shuttering the facility in the wake of deadly attacks by the Islamic State in Brussels and in Paris. Well, they've been opposed to shuttering the facility, not just since then, from the get-go. And Obama's been intent on closing the facility and moving all of the individuals there and not allowing any future individuals to go to a facility like that. But instead, they'll be housed at, federal penitentiaries, maybe county courthouses as they're awaiting trial, you know, here in the United States. And after trial, they'll be held here, too, for some unforeseen period of time. But in the meantime, you know, let's keep letting some of them out, right? Like we did with the Bo Bergdahl swap. We'll talk about that and more with Stephen Kruiser of PJ Media. Stick around. There is much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this. Well, listen, I appreciate both of you coming on the program. It is a real pleasure to see each of you in person here. What is it, Nick, that got you so interested in the United States? Was there a moment when you realized, like, all right, I'm beyond simply unhappy with the way things are going in Australia?
Well, look, I think my very first word, Cam, was Coca-Cola. So that was probably a sign of things to
both
come.
Both of them or just one?
Yeah, that's right. But look, I all my life, since a young boy, I was drawn to the United States. And I know it's something that's very difficult to explain, but it's not just me. There's lots of people like Charles and I put you in this same category, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Elon Musk.
I'm quite like him as well.
Stuart Varney, yes. And
often in the same category, the Charles.
Yeah. But just for the muscles. Yeah.
Right, of course.
Just muscles. Just muscles.
Well, the accent, again.
Yeah, well, he's got
accent.
Another good accent. Yeah. Now the Twitter feed's really going to blow
right
up. But look, there is definitely something about the optimism, the vibrancy, the individualism, the existence, I think, of a still very strong faith in America that really makes it the place to be. I mean, this, Cam, is the place where magic happens. This is the country, I think, where initiative, risk, and confidence go further than anywhere else. And it's why, contrary to what you hear in the media, contrary to what the elite will preach, it's why more people want to come to America than want to go anywhere else.
So despite what the president says, maybe there's something, there is something real about the idea of American exceptionalism. Not that the people are better, but that the place is better. The place is unique. The place is something different. Yeah.
Well, it is culture. I mean, it's not in the water,
right?
I think. It's not as if
any constitution had been passed, America would have been to the moon in 1969. It's not foreordained, and I think that's the interesting point, that you have a constitutional order here that is built upon principles that are, at least initially, British, and played out in Australia to an extent, but have been lost and eroded. And America has not lost them yet, although many are trying. In a sense, you have here a far more intact and uncorrupted form of classical liberalism, which we call conservatism here, or libertarianism.
Or conservatarianism, perhaps.
Or conservatarianism, or available at all good bookstores. And that is extremely attractive if you believe in those things, but like Nick and myself, grew up in a country that had largely lost those values.
All right, so we've got running for the Democratic nomination a guy who calls himself a Democratic Socialist. Mm. And you know, there's been a lot of conversation about what that means. And I've engaged briefly with some Sanders supporters, and they keep bringing up like Norway or you know, Scandinavian countries. We don't want to be like Russia. We're not talking about Venezuela. We want to be like Norway. Mm. Explain to me, if America is freedom, and let's say North Korea is totalitarianism, where is Australia? Where is Great Britain on that spectrum? What is it? Is it like, because again, you don't have knocks on the door in the middle of the night and the secret police coming to take you away. But you mentioned a lack of energy in politics. Is it innervation? Is it apathy? Mm. Is it you don't fight because you know you can't win because your rights have disappeared so long ago?
Well, I think the rights have been blunted rather than disappear completely. I mean, you can still stand up on an upturned cart on the corner, mostly, and speak. There are some exceptions, of course. In fact, we do in England arrest people if they say the wrong thing on the upturned cart. But the average person speaking is not going to be in trouble. It's just that the point at which the rights become challenging, which is really any right should be challenging by definition, it's blunted and it's dulled. Now, of course, on a scale which ranges from the United States to North Korea, Britain and Australia are both much closer to the United States.
Right.
But you hear frequently this idea, especially when it comes to, say, speech, that, well, we have to balance offense and liberty.
Well, there's no point in having the right college campuses.
Well, exactly, and that's the great fear that it will spread here as well. But I think it's the same when it comes to the Second Amendment and the idea, well, you have a right not ever to be in harm's way. Well, I'm afraid that's not how rights work.
Welcome back to NRA News, Gam & Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad that you've joined us this afternoon. Hope that you'll be tuning in tomorrow as well. We have another fantastic program on tap for you. Right now, I want to welcome from PJ Media, Mr. Stephen Cruiser, to the program. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. It's always a pleasure talking with you. Although, you know, once again, the news of this week kind of grim. There's, I think, a lot of talk that needs to be had about what happened in Brussels yesterday, where we had, you know, hundreds wounded. We had dozens killed. And this happened the same time, Stephen, or the same day, that there were a couple of news stories revealing you know, we actually have more troops in Iraq than what the administration has told us about. We had a Marine killed in Iraq for the first time since President Obama has put boots back on the ground there. It seems to me like the media is either unable or unwilling or just doing a really poor job of covering ISIS in all of its forms. It's almost like these things are fractured. Like what's happening in Iraq and Syria isn't seen in relation to what's happening in Brussels, or if it is, it's only the most tangential nature, right? We're not really talking about ISIS as a global terror network, it seems to me.
Well, I think, you know, the way you framed it in terms of the media, I think in the beginning it was a lack of will. I think a long time ago they weren't willing. They were just trying to be complicit with it, whatever the leftist narrative was about terrorism, you know, Al-Qaeda back then, ISIS now. You think they were unwilling for so long that they're now unable to cover it properly, if that makes any sense. I think, you know, you turned a blind eye long enough, you become kind of blind.
You know, and it was interesting. Yesterday I noticed Piers Morgan, of all people, Stephen, said, you know, listen, maybe it's time we start thinking about taking Donald Trump seriously when it comes to, you know, our response to this stuff. Like, he basically had reached the point, it seemed yesterday, where hashtags, great. Singing Imagine, fantastic. Whatever. But those aren't real responses. Now, when Piers Morgan starts kind of hinting that, hey, you know what, maybe people do have a human right of self-defense, you know that we're sort of living in crazy times.
Oh, that was that kumbaya moment between Piers Morgan and Trump yesterday almost fried the internet to death. that was so weird. But it's like, this is the thing. The first thing, you know, I thought about the other night, though, was, you know, even the people who think Trump's a loon, there are kernels of truth in some of the things he says, you know, and this is the kind of thing that just you get to some of the kernels of truth. I don't know what he'll ever do if he becomes president. Yeah, I can't trust him on any of that. But, you know, this is part of the problem with him, I think, because he's so outlandish on so many things that we can't. There are things that we could be having great conversations about in his kernels of truth, like on immigration, illegal immigration, and things like that, and they get lost in all the other stuff. But this is a conversation. I mean, you know, it's the optics yesterday. This happens the night before, and the president's at a ball game with a commie dictator, which I would have been offended enough by itself had there not been a terrorist attack the night before. But, you know, and he's trying to do the whole, well, you can't give in to terrorism. And I said, yeah, but we need to fight it, too. You can't give in to terrorism if you're fighting it, but we're not fighting it anymore. You mentioned the Marine killed. It's because we do this, you know, we're once again in this position where we're putting people in harm's way without letting them completely fight or defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to go well. It's going to be worse than the 1.0 version of this Iraq thing.
You know, that's what really concerns me, because clearly I think the president is concerned about optics. In fact, the Daily Beast story that referenced the troops going into Iraq that the administration didn't want to acknowledge. Basically, there was an unnamed, you know, official speaking on condition of anonymity from within the White House who said, you know, the president wants to be known for winding these wars down, not for them, you know, getting gin back up. Yeah, he's President Peace Prize, as I referred to him yesterday. And President Peace Prize doesn't put more troops and more boots on the ground. So what happens is, you know, reality compels him to do this, but only enough to try to get by, Stephen, right? Not enough to actually win, but enough to say, well, we're downgrading and we're degrading ISIS's capabilities, as opposed to we're turning them into little smears on the ground, and we'll stop when there are no more ISIS fighters to turn into smears.
Yeah, and then he can, you know, they'll point to something. This is another thing. You want to get back to the media. The media will then back him up, saying, well, you know, the troop levels were at an all-time low when he left office. It's one of those things that will become a Facebook meme. It seems like it's proving a point, but it's not really proving a point. This fight already, the way it's being framed, you know, you mentioned being unwilling to look at it as an international network. That was another one of the short-sighted things with dealing with ISIS for so long, is the theory was ISIS was going to stay homegrown in the region and Al-Qaeda was still going to be the terror network that exported things, you know?
Right.
And in a very short period of time, all the while we're supposedly degrading their capabilities, they're expanding their sphere of influence quite rapidly. That thing with the Draw Muhammad in Texas here in the U.S., that was ISIS. That wasn't Al-Qaeda. That was like, so for the reason, you know, it was, okay, they're not a big deal. Okay, they're becoming a big deal, but they're only a big deal there. They're not going to be a big deal anywhere else. Okay, they're a big deal somewhere else, but nobody's really saying that out loud. They're just like, well, you know, this one incident here, this one is, and they keep looking at them as isolated and not connecting it. And I just don't know how, when or where the adult is going to come from in the future, or what country that's finally going to start looking at this seriously.
What really concerns me is what if they are looking at this seriously, Stephen, and this is what we get? I mean, you know, you talk about the spheres of influence, and we saw this, you know, ISIS was connecting online with a global audience in a way that, you know, look, even how do you fight ISIS propaganda? With government propaganda, you know, I mean, is that the answer? Because I don't know how well we do at propaganda, you know, or do you fight ISIS propaganda with a real grassroots response? How do you do that without people worrying about, you know, how ISIS might respond? I think in the war of ideas right now, we are playing catch up. Honestly, I think we have better ideas. I believe in individual freedom. I don't believe in subjugation to the state. I don't believe in living under a murderous regime that would kill you for your religious faith and throw you off of a building and burn your babies alive. I think we have better ideas, but I don't think we're doing a very good job of actually, first of all, I don't think we're very passionate about our ideals. You know, President Obama was in Cuba, and he's bitching about what a crappy place America is. We are, you know, if you believe that we're in a war of ideals, why aren't you standing up for the nation that has better ideals than the people who are trying to kill us? That'd be a start.
You know, this is a cliche move here, but you think about how Reagan used to frame things in terms of freedom. And, you know, it was all broad brushstroke stuff. And, you know, he was taken to task for being a simpleton sometimes for doing that. And he never was. He was forcing them onto the stage of ideas. That's what he was doing. He was making the Soviets at the time, you know, come out in contrasting with them. And this is the liberty, the freedom, for the president to stand in Cuba, of all places, where people have been killing themselves to get away from to come to the U.S. Forever, and sit there and pretend like we're still some kind of a problem when we are everything that the Cubans. So I have a lot of friends who are from Cuba, who are Cuban expatriates who escaped the country. And this is the gold standard for them when they get here. This is why I like both Cruz and Rubio so much, because their parents understood that. And this president is afraid. He wants to be part of the international community. He doesn't want to be the leader of the free world because he's the president of the United States. He just wants to be the leader of the free world because he's part of the international community. And this is the kind of thing that I don't know how much of this we can dial back and how quickly. You know, Trump's Make America Great Again thing is a nice theme. I don't know what he's going to do to facilitate that if he's president. And if Hillary's president, I don't know. I think we all are in for some liver damage then.
All of a sudden, the comedian can't think of anything real funny to say, can he, when he faced with the prospect of a Hillary presidency?
Yeah, she just frightens me. But again, you know, this president shrinks away from the idea of America being unique, and you can't properly fight things if you don't believe that. If he's the commander in chief, we're not going to be able to battle this. Thankfully, he'll be gone soon.
And as you say, you know, the excuse given yesterday for attending the baseball game of, you know, look, we can't give in to fear, can't let the terrorists win. That wasn't what it was about. I mean, that wasn't what President Obama going to the baseball game was about. And nobody that I know of who was bothered by that thought that, you know, fear had anything to do with it. Yeah, we need to keep living our lives. And the people in Brussels who kept living their life yesterday, that's bravery. This was expediency from the president. I mean, he didn't want to go do the job that the leader of the free world ordinarily would be doing when a European capital was attacked by terrorists. He wanted to go and sit and watch that baseball game with, you know, the president of Cuba. And apparently, did you see this? FARC rebels were there in attendance as well at that baseball game?
I didn't. I heard about that, yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like the Marxist version of the Bad News Bears. But that's who he wanted to hang out with yesterday, apparently.
And the reason, this is the beautiful subtext of it all that got lost in everything yesterday, the reason that baseball is so popular in Cuba now and Cuba's gotten so good at producing baseball players is because so many kids want to play baseball because it's one of the best avenues for them to be able to kind of escape the country to the United States and get asylum here. That's why they're so good at baseball now. So it just that whole thing kind of got lost yesterday, that was the first thing I thought. I said, I was going to a baseball game. Yeah, well, of course Cuba's good at baseball right now. That's one of their main leap off the island, get some asylum vehicles.
Right. Well, yeah. And, you know, look, I mean, I noted this earlier in the week when President Obama was, again, agreeing with Raul Castro about what a horrible place this was. I said that's why we have so many Americans who are risking their lives trying to flee to Cuba. You know, yeah. I mean, you don't see that. You don't see little flotillas setting off from Key West trying to get to Havana. It doesn't happen.
And you're looking at, you know, the priority problem with this president in a nutshell there. I mean, the world is falling apart in so many places. Europe has been letting the terrorist element in for so long. They're going to be dealing with problems like this for a long time because I'm sure there are many other plans in the offing already there. But this president, as he goes out the door, his priorities are, let's see if we can pretend to make nice with Iran and buddy up to the commie dictator in Cuba. That's his exit priority in his final year. And if that doesn't give you the whole why the world's a mess in a nutshell picture right there, nothing ever will.
Yep. Stephen, listen, unfortunately, we are almost out of time. I appreciate you coming on the program, though. I always appreciate your perspective, and hope we can do this again very soon.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Stephen Kruiser from PJ Media joining us on the program. I swear one of these weeks we're going to have Stephen on, and we'll be able to laugh and giggle and just be like fun little stories. And it's just not this week. NBC in Washington, D.C. reporting George Mason University has alerted students after two female students were raped on or near campus. One student reported to university police she was raped by a male student that she knows late in the evening on Thursday, March 17th. The assault happening in a student residence hall or at an off-campus apartment. Monday, March 21st, another female student reported that she was raped by an individual that she had met through an online dating app at about 1:15 in her student residence hall on the Fairfax campus. That suspect unaffiliated with the university, according to the school. You know, again, our college campuses are not crime-free, not by a long shot. Now, coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to talk with our friend Jonathan Hoenig from Capitalist Pig Investment Fund, a financial anti-gun activist. We've seen this move before. Remember, there was a group of activists who tried to get Walmart to stop selling certain firearms, and they wanted to get Cabela's to stop selling semi-automatic firearms. Now it looks like these groups are targeting gun manufacturers in addition to firearm retailers. We'll talk about that with Jonathan Hoenig, also Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart. Our friend Kurt Schlichter, I think he's recovered from the New Order show in Los Angeles last weekend, but we'll check in with our friend Kurt. And, of course, more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information for you. It's all coming up on the next edition of NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler.